You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Bruce Jones. I'm the Vice President and the Director of the Foreign Policy Program here at Brookings. And it's my pleasure to welcome you here today for the launch of Cheng Li's book, Chinese Politics in the Xi Jinping Era, Reassessing Collective Leadership. Of course, we're at a moment when lots of people are reassessing leadership in lots of different countries. And as the Trump administration begins its tenure in Washington, the eyes of the world are on us. Across the globe, questions abound about America's role and how it will proceed. And front and center in that discussion is the U.S.-China relationship, which is clearly in play. And today and going forward, Brookings scholars will continue to catalyze a discussion around the important geopolitical and geoeconomic issues in that relationship and its implications for the world in which we live. And to help us with that discussion today, we're delighted to have the former Secretary of Commerce, the Honorable Barbara Franklin, join us for this morning's keynote address. She'll share insights from her extensive experience working directly with Chinese leadership and the U.S. leadership. Her trailblazing career, I think that's the only way you could describe it, touched almost every sector, corporate, governmental, academic, entrepreneurial. She's an expert on corporate governance, on auditing, financial reporting practices, and on trade. She currently serves as president and CEO of Barbara Franklin Enterprises, an international consulting firm. Her extensive experience and expertise first drew the attention of President Nixon, and she served also for President George W. Bush as the 29th Secretary of Commerce. And in that role, I think many of you will recall her historic trade mission to China, which was instrumental in reopening commercial relationships between the two nations. I'm trying hard to avoid already asking her a question about our current trade policy, but we'll no doubt come to that. Needless to say, we're looking forward to her thoughts on the U.S.-China relationship. And following her remarks, Cheng Li will present his book, Chinese Politics in the Xi Jinping Era, Reassessing Collective Leadership. As you know, he's a senior fellow here at Brookings and the director of our John Thornton China Center. His work highlights trends in Chinese elite politics and also shares his forecasts about leadership change, potential leadership change at the upcoming 19th Party Congress. He's a China scholar who needs no introduction. His book, which I have to say I think is a masterwork, and I don't use that term lightly or commonly, has solidified his status as what Andrew Nathan recently called our leading expert in the Chinese political elite and a leading Chinese scholar in general in the United States. We're very proud of Cheng Li and of his book. I frequently travel to China with Cheng Li, and everywhere we go, we meet very senior Chinese leadership. And what happens is we have a discussion, and then they kind of push me aside, and they pull Cheng Li over and say, can you tell me what's really going on? It's quite impressive to watch. So we're very honored to have him here, to have him as the director of our China Center, and I'm very proud to be a small part of helping launch his book. But for now, following his talk, we'll have a broader panel discussion on Sino-American relations with David Lampton, Richard McGregor, and Dennis Wilder, and I'm very pleased that our own non-resident fellow and staff writer in The New Yorker, Evan Osnos, will moderate the panel today. So with that, thank you all for being here, and please join me in welcoming the Honorable Barbara Franklin.
Good morning, and thank you very much, Bruce, for that generous introduction. I'm delighted to be here, and I have to tell you, speaking of momentous change, I just wonder what has happened between the time I left home and arrived here. So this promises to be a year of momentous challenge and change, possibly change, in the relationship between the United States and China. And today I'm particularly talking about the economic side of that relationship, and a relationship that I believe is the most consequential bilateral relationship in the world. Now, it's obvious, to state the obvious, on the U.S. side, the change is the election of President Trump. And on the Chinese side, Chen Li will tell you what changes are going to emanate from the 19th Communist Party Congress in the fall. But first, to think back for a minute about the Sino-U.S. economic relationship. It has grown exponentially since 1979 through both Democratic and Republican administrations. From a modest beginning, two-way trade is well over $500 billion. And I'm proud to have played a role in restarting that economic relationship when President Bush sent me, after he lost the election in 1992, to both remove a ban on government-to-government contact, but also to restart the U.S.-China Joint Commission on Commerce and Trade, JCCT, getting the economic relationship started again after a rather moribund few years. And now, of course, I think we all know that China is the third largest market for U.S. products and services, a $400 billion market that many think should be even larger. And according to a new study prepared for the U.S.-China Business Council by Oxford Economics, the trade relationship, two-way trade relationship, supports roughly 2.6 million American jobs. Now, turning to President Trump, who, as a candidate, said a lot of things about China. He pointed to the trade deficit, more than $300 billion in China's favor, and he says that's a drag on U.S. GDP growth. He said the U.S. has lost millions of jobs to China. He said China engages in unfair trade practices and currency manipulation and has threatened new tariffs on Chinese products. I'm sure we've all seen all of that stuff. 45% is one of the figures that was mentioned. In other words, he is calling for a rebalance in the U.S.-China trade relationship. Now, concurrently, I am fascinated and encouraged by President Xi Jinping's recent speech, particularly the one at the World Economic Forum in Davos, where he lauded, quote, economic globalization and free trade and investment. He had some wonderfully poetic language in that speech. It's an absolute masterpiece. And the quote I particularly liked is this one. Pursuing protectionism is just like locking oneself in a dark room. While wind and rain may be kept outside, so are light and air. Wonderful quote. Now, the U.S. business community has also applauded President Xi's comprehensive agenda for economic reform that was put forth at the 18th Communist Party Congress in 2013. Yet so far, we don't see too much specific progress. A key question here, do both leaders mean what they say? Now, I'm not going to pretend to read the mind of either one. I'm going to leave the Chinese side to Chen Li, but I am going to comment about President Trump based not on reading his mind, but based on what I'm seeing, hearing, and watching him do so far. And what I also know from decades of participation in the political process here is that campaign rhetoric often dies down and disappears once the reality of actually having to govern sets in for a new president. This time, however, I think something is different. When he was President Trump gave voice to the frustration and anger felt by millions of Americans who felt let down by the ruling establishments of both political parties. And they elected him because I think they thought he was serious about making the changes he advocated. And his inaugural address last week underscored what he had been saying in the campaign. And I would note that at one point in that address, he said forcefully, "I will not let you down." So what I think is different this time is the sheer determination with which President Trump, his cabinet, and advisors will pursue the changes he campaigned about. And change in trade relationships was one big issue, and of course that includes the rebalance with China. And we can see already what he's been doing, talking about renegotiating NAFTA and then pulling us out of the trade of the TPP just yesterday by executive order. So further evidence to support the determination I believe I see is the appointments he has made and the views that those people have expressed. Now, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, for one, and I know you here at Brookings know him since he has been a trustee for some time, he is to have a big role in trade policy. And he's been quite outspoken about the things he believes China isn't doing properly. And if anyone has read the transcript or watched his confirmation hearing, you will have seen and heard a lot of those comments. There's Bob Lighthizer, who will be the trade representative. He also has an outspoken point of view on some of these trade activities, particularly enforcement. And then there is Peter Navarro, who heads this National Trade Council in the White House. Now, that is a new animal, and we'll have to see just how that works. But he, too, has spoken and written very candidly about China and is very hawkish. And this is going back some years. And if we look at the white paper that Wilbur Ross and Peter Navarro authored during the campaign, their concerns about China and where this relationship should move in the forward, I think is really quite clear. Now, in addition, President Trump, in his own words, and by all accounts, is a master negotiator. So it may be possible that what he has said during the campaign and what he might do subsequently is the opening round of a negotiation with President Xi about the changes the U.S. would like to see in this relationship. In any case, however we look at what is going on now and what we are seeing so far, I believe everyone ought to take seriously the determination for change that I see coming out of the president and, so far, this administration. Now, there are, turning to the Chinese side, there are some things that China could do that we'd like to see to start the rebalancing. First, market access. The U.S. market is wide open to Chinese imports. The U.S. has been very welcoming to investment from China, which has skyrocketed in the past few years. And yet, the Chinese market still has some 100 sectors which are closed or restricted to foreign investment. Now, opening these sectors could make a good start at the rebalance. So could finishing the negotiation for the bilateral investment treaty, the BIT. I know the State Council has made some moves in the opening up direction, but we haven't seen yet the results. Second, China has a variety of tariff and non-tariff barriers to trade. I won't try to enumerate those, but a lot of us know what they are, and I think China could work at lowering those. Thirdly, China has an overcapacity problem in some industries, notably steel and aluminum. And that has caused the dumping of those products at below market prices in various countries, including the U.S. Now, the U.S. has been working for years on the steel issue. And just a few days, 10 days ago, actually, Mike Froman, the outgoing trade rep, filed a complaint with the WTO alleging that China is illegally subsidizing aluminum and saying that this overcapacity problem really should be corrected. And we hope that China will work harder on correcting the overcapacity issues. The final thing I will mention here is the state-owned enterprises. Chinese companies, particularly those SOEs, often receive benefits that give them a competitive advantage over foreign companies. And the U.S. side very much supports the kind of reforms that have been put forth for the SOEs. Well, given this situation and all of the different kinds of issues that are moving around there on the economic front, there is a lot to talk about, and it's important that the two sides continue to regularly engage with each other, just as they have been doing for the past few years. There are a multitude right now, 50 or more, of governmental bilateral summits and dialogues, such as the Strategic and Economic Dialogue, the U.S.-China Joint Commission on Commerce and Trade, JCCT, and many others. These or something similar should be continued, even if the new administration wants to restructure them. And I would say, parenthetically, I think the S&ED does need to be rethought. It's gotten too big and too cumbersome. And quite frankly, I'd like to see the economic side of it just stand by itself, the way this all began a few years back. Anyway, stay tuned. We'll see what happens here. But the point is that these dialogues provide a serious and a regular way for those who lead the two largest economies in the world to talk together, identify problems, and work to find common ground to overcome them. But, there's a big but here. But there must be leadership from the top. The tone and priorities for these dialogues must come from the two leaders. Therefore, a great deal is riding on the relationship that will develop between President Trump and President Xi. I'm hopeful that the two of them will meet and talk regularly and will establish a personal relationship. They have had an introductory phone call, which from all reports was cordial, with both expressing a desire to work together. And I'm hopeful that they will look for ways and issues on which they can work together for the good of both countries as well as the global economy, and where there are disagreements, and we know already that we have some disagreements, I'm hoping that they will look for common ground to begin to find solutions. A trade war, as some are predicting, harms both countries, creates uncertainty for many other countries, and is an activity that has no place anywhere in the interconnected global world of the 21st century. So I think that this is not going to happen. I think it will be averted. Instead, I must believe that these two leaders are pragmatic, that they understand the stakes and the need to continue a stable relationship. So they should, and I hope, will start the kind of communication and negotiation process that will be a win for both countries and the global economy. Just one final observation here, and it's this. It's true that when there's so much change possible and so many moving parts, there's always opportunity in it. There's opportunity for new understanding, innovation in ways of doing things, new processes, just new thinking. If we have the will, the leaders now have the will to seize that kind of opportunity. That's a big if. But I really am hopeful that they will do that. Stay tuned for this too. And there's one more thing. All of us in this room, I believe, are here because we care about the stability of this relationship between the two countries going forward. And it has great import, not only for our countries, but for the global economy. Now, we all have friends and colleagues and networks on both sides, on the U.S. side, on the Chinese side, or both. Now is the time to motivate ourselves and our friends, colleagues, and networks so that we can all do everything we can do from where we sit to help this relationship go forward in a stable and productive manner. Thank you.
First, thanks for that overly generous introduction, and really thank you for the strong support for the China work in general and also my work on the Chinese leadership, especially this book. It is really incredible honor to share the stage with Secretary Franklin and to have her keynote today's event. Barbara is a personal friend for many years, but more importantly, he is a great pioneer and a strategic thinker, and really in every sense of those words. From her early work in the Nixon White House to recruit women for high-level government jobs, is demonstrated in your book, and also to her efforts to normalize trade relations with PRC, and as President George H.W. Bush's Secretary of Commerce, and to her service on almost 20 international business or American business corporation, and to promote trade and international economy. So it's really, really wonderful to have you at this critical moment. I think your remark is both realistic but also optimistic. It's it's really fascinating to now, in a little while, I will present as about the Chinese leadership. But I think that we wanted to have that opportunity to spend 10 to 15 minutes to the audience to ask you some questions, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. But let me ask the first question. President Trump certainly has a very ambitious plan for infrastructure development. Based on your experience, could he do that without China's capital, maybe even China's import? Is that realistic in today's world? Maybe change a little bit. Can China benefit from this gigantic infrastructure project from your expertise? So this is my question for you.
I've been told that China would like to engage in this infrastructure project. I would think that there will be many, many players in this infrastructure project. And where that goes, given everything else that President Trump has said about America first, I'm not entirely sure right now. Not entirely sure. I think this is one of the things we need to continue to watch. Mm-hmm. But I do think America is still open for investment. Mm-hmm. I don't think America first is going to change that.
So especially by the state government actually playing
a role. Yeah, and we know that our state governments are often more welcoming than some others. Yeah, sure. So I don't know. I think this is a very good question, and it will be something to follow as we get a little more clarity about just where this infrastructure project is going, mm-hmm. and where the funds are coming from for that, the governmental part of our funds.
Okay, great. So please raise your hand and also state your name and your affiliation, and also limit your question for one. Okay. John.
Thank you, Chun Li. Madam Secretary, you have...
Identify yourself.
Oh, John Zan with CTI TV of Taiwan. But you have been realistic and optimistic. But if I ask you to give us a worst-case scenario, what can a trade war between the United States and China take us? Where can that take us? What is the worst case scenario? Thank you.
I don't even want to go there. Because I really don't think, this is the optimistic, I don't mean to be Pollyanna, but reality does set in when people have to govern. It really does. And other influences come to bear and consequences become more apparent. I just don't think it's going to happen. I think we've got two pragmatic leaders here. Hope I'm not wrong, but I think we do. And so somehow, some way, they will find a way out of the clashing of points of view right now. But that's what negotiation is all about. is to find some common ground. So I don't want to go there and even paint a picture of a worst case. So call me optimistic, but I am.
You're also very diplomatic as well. And gentleman.
My name is Alex. I'm from Russia, Fulbright's student at George Washington University, a representative of probably the only country that's really excited about this new page in history. Myself, very excited as well. I'm very sorry for that, but I'm being very happy about what's going on. But anyway, my question is about the Chinese barriers, the Chinese protectionism, the Chinese favoring of local producers, local protectionism, and other barriers that China did not pull down, which it, I guess, has made commitments to do. And at Davos, I guess, as the newly pronounced leader of the globalized world, it will probably have to set a standard in liberalization of international trade. I see a lot of people in Trump administration are sort of like ratcheting the bargaining position, almost, and even thinking about weaponizing Taiwan and many other issues. And it sounds like they want to open China. It's like a wrecking ball for genuinely opening China, just like maybe Reagan's threats against Japan were to open China. The question, I'm sorry for that. The question is, do you see that this could be as successful as Reagan's opening Japan was? Thank you.
I think I don't accept that that's what they're doing for openers. So I don't know how to answer that, I guess. But I don't see a wrecking ball here, at least not yet.
Well, I just follow up, and President Trump constantly or frequently during campaign compare himself with Reagan.
Well, yeah.
And as the person you worked for the administration, President Reagan, before, right? Did you work also with his administration?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Is there any similarity from your perspective?
I think it's too soon to tell.
Okay.
So far, not okay. Too much, but it's too soon. I do think it's been amazing in a way, the alacrity with which this president has started to do things that he said he was going to do. And I think that has got to play well, certainly, to the people who voted for him. Now, where this goes, and will it be a sustained level of activity? Because things get tougher after a while. You can do a few things, but then, you know, he needs the Congress to do some things, excuse me, some things, or to at least help to implement his ideas. And there are other forces that come to bear. I think it's a little too soon to make any big pronouncements. I would leave it at that. I've been, I guess, both impressed and amazed so far at the force and the determination and the alacrity with which he has gone after some of the stuff, TPP,
sure.
Like anything. One other thing, you were getting at a little bit of something that I didn't say, that I think concerns U.S. business people, and that is this. If there is tension in the relationship, I'm now moving over to the other side of it, to the strategic or whatever, the South China Sea or whatever kinds of things might happen. When there's tension, it causes, I think, business people to get nervous, and it causes uncertainty. And that kind of thing could impact the economic relationship.
Okay,
that was the point I just wanted to make.
I probably will take a few, then probably will close very soon. Yes, the young lady first. Yeah.
Excuse me.
Thank you, Dr. Li and Secretary Franklin. I'm Zhang Ning Li with Shenzhen Media Group. So the U.S. has just pulled out of TPP, and Chinese foreign minister also said immediately afterwards that China has made good progress on RCEP negotiations. So in your opinion, is it likely that China will complete the negotiations in the near future, and what does it mean for the economy in China and in the Asia Pacific? Thank
you. We will take a few questions together. Yeah, the gentleman next.
Okay. Yes.
Hold on. Maybe Bobby together.
Oh,
after these three questions.
Hi, I'm Evil Board. I'm a portfolio manager for Raymond James. So, but my question is kind of driven by your comment, which I find interesting, that you believe Donald Trump is pragmatic. Now, what do you feel from your either personal experience with the team that is engaged with him or maybe overtly that drives you to think that he's going to approach things in a pragmatic way?
Okay. Last question, Mr. Chen.
Hi, I'm Chen Weihua, China Daily. You know, you just quoted President Xi's poetic remarks in Davos. So, I mean, the impression about Donald Trump is going to retreat from globalization, free trade. So what do you think, the leadership in global trade, free trade, globalization is going to look like in the Trump era? What role China could play and what it takes for China to play that role? Thank you.
Yeah, three questions, TPP and pragmatic. Pragmatist as president, and president as pragmatist, and last one is China potential, China's leadership or any leadership. I mean, in the global integration.
Let me start with pragmatic, and the reason that I think that is because of the business empire that he has built. Got to be pragmatic to have done that. So, and I don't see him as an ideological person, the way some Republicans are ideological. I do not see that. I see him as someone who wants to get results. And if you want to get results, I think you have to be pragmatic and you have to negotiate and you have to do what he's done. So that's where my comment about that comes from. TPP, let's see. Yeah, I have to say I've been a supporter of TPP, but it seems as though that support on both sides of the aisle seems to have evaporated or lessened. And I don't know what you were asking about RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic. I don't know where China is in the process or those countries. That's an agreement that's not as high a level agreement as TPP would have been. If the U.S. is not going to be engaged in TPP, I do not believe we can just walk away from our other trading partners in Asia. There's some big countries there, Japan being one. So I think that the U.S. will have to, whether it's bilateral or something else, have some kinds of relationships with some of those other countries if absent the TPP situation. What was the
last one about international
Leadership. Well, I think this remains to be seen. I do believe that the two biggest economies in the world are both going to have to shoulder some leadership here. But the U.S. still is the largest economy in the world. And it underscores the reason why these two largest economies must come to some common ground on some of these issues that are dividing them. I mean, it's to me there is no other choice. There is no other choice.
Is it okay to take one more question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yes, the young lady.
Thank you, Dr. Chen Li. This is Leah from VOA. You did mention, Madam Franklin, you did mention the newly established the White House National Trade Council. I'm just wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about this new organization. What kind of a role it's going to play in the U.S. trade policy towards China? How it's going to work with the other government agencies that deals with trade relationship with China? Thank you.
Well, if I knew that, I would be a mind reader. I think it remains to be seen, and this is something to watch. This is new. And another element here, as we have to watch going forward, besides the two leaders and their relationships, are the relationships among these other players who are also new to this ship, which be the Commerce Secretary, the Trade Rep, and Peter Navarro. Now, those people haven't all worked together before, and we've got to see how all of that's going to work and whether how they work with each other and how they do what the president wants them to do. And I have no answer about how all that's going to work. But this is one of the kinds of things that I think we all have to be watching as this administration goes forward and as these people actually get into their jobs. They're not all in their jobs yet either. So I think we have to see. Lighthizer still has a, I don't know if that hearing's even been set, has it? Does anybody know? He has not had a confirmation hearing yet. Wilbur Ross is not yet confirmed. I expect he will be soon. But so we've got to watch all of these relationships and how everybody works together. I'm one of these people who believes that relationships count. Relationships count. Leadership counts. This is some really basic stuff. Tone at the top counts from my corporate world. Getting back to leadership count.
Well, you said so well. Leadership count, public discourse count, public policy count. I mean, you're absolutely right that it's still so early and too early that he has been White House for a few days.
Yeah, well,
right? And of course, there's a lot of adjustment. There's a lot of learning curve, and also, you know, along the way, as you know, you see, in almost every administration, there will be a learning curve. But for him, of course, we should give him some time and etc. But what you said is very, very important. You lay out the ground, lay out the issues, and also express the importance and also at the 21st century, the global economy should look like. And also you constantly emphasize the win-win. Now, I'm sure that our panelists also have some experts on economic affairs. They will continue to address issues. I apologize for some of the audience that I cannot you know, because of time concern, and also Secretary also has some other engagement. You also have a very busy week, and hope that
staying to listen to you.
Besides, you probably also will look, you know, look at the Twitters from the president. In,
we need to see what's happened since we left.
Okay, but again, thank you for joining us today, and also for sharing your really incredible wisdom at this critical moment in world history, especially on world trade. I mean, this kind of a regime that is still unfolding. And I want the audience to join me. Thank you again for giving, sharing with us.
Thank you. Okay.
It's a very difficult to follow the step. But anyway, that I will now move to from mainly United States to China, talk about Chinese leadership. Of course, this year there will be some other elections in Europe, other leadership changes around the world. But probably it's fair to say that Chinese leadership change in the fall this year will be very, very important. It's clearer today than any time before that China now expresses its aspiration to play a leadership role on global stage, in global stage, whether economy, maybe climate change, or maybe even in the security domain. But of course, that compared with the United States, that when we have the election, everything, so much things raised, and a lot of details. Probably what we experienced in the past few months was probably the least civilized, you know, presidential election. So a lot of noises, a lot of dirty politics. But in China, it's quite mysterious. And sounds like, you know, people said the black box manipulation going on. So my book, which was published just 2 months ago, tried to demystify a lot of things going in China, in Zhongnanhai. And the book is quite long. It's 500 pages. Originally, it's 600 pages. And in the first proof, but the editor said, no, I mean, this is too bad. This was supposed to be used in the textbook for graduate school or high-level undergraduate. He said, this will be so intimidating. They want me to cut. But I said, no, I don't want to cut. I spent 3 years on that one. So as a compromise, they changed the size, the font.
of the size. So everything, no paragraph is cut, still 500. It has 84 charts and tables. I will share some of them. 800 footnotes. It's quite long. 200 Chinese terms, most of the new terminologies. And finally, 600 Chinese leaders. Among them, 500 are current leaders. This is based on the database I began to establish 30 years ago in 1987 as a graduate student at UC Berkeley. You know, over 30 years, I built up a database about this is a so-called 组织部, the organization department designated appointees, about 4,000 at a certain time. Altogether, it's about 30,000, almost 30,000 people in the database. But of course, I focus on, just as I mentioned in a minute, about the Central Committee members. Now, in the next maybe 30 minutes or so, I will cover three topics. One is share with you the objectives of the book or the issues raised in that book and why, basically, why did I write this book? There's so many books about Chinese politics or Chinese elite politics. Why, how this book differs from others. Secondly, talk about the methodology and or findings in terms of how does this book approach the issues raised. And finally, it's the argument, what I try to argue, and also the outlook about the upcoming leadership change at the 19th Party Congress. Now, talk about objective. Certainly, there are a few things in my mind. One is try to explain the background and the reasons for the drastic change under Xi Jinping. There were actually a lot of changes over the past 4 years since he became top leader. And also, I want to challenge what I call the two extreme views about Xi Jinping's leadership, about Chinese political trajectory. One extreme is the argument that Xi Jinping is very, very powerful. It's already become like an emperor-like figure, or strong man like Mao or Deng. You see the cover of Time magazine, Newsweek, Economist, said all look like emperor. And that powerful leader, and along with his military reform and many other things, will make China very, very strong, ultimately will challenge U.S. presence in South China Sea, East China Sea, and even challenge the status of U.S. leadership in the world. So the policy recommendation is to contain China before too late. The other extreme is just the opposite, arguing that Xi Jinping actually is quite weak. His anti-corruption campaign made so many enemies, and he really could not get things done. Look at the economic reform plan outlined in the third platinum 1 year after he became top leader. Most of these policies, according to some critics, not implemented. And the forces, and especially officials or liberal intellectuals and other forces, especially when economy could not deliver, and all these forces were assembled, will undermine Xi Jinping, and not only Xi Jinping is weak, but also the Chinese Communist Party is in big trouble. But ironically, that extreme views also came to the same conclusion, to contain China, because there's no cost in doing so. Now, I believe these two extreme views really undermine American interests. The truth, as you probably will agree, is somewhere in between. He's neither that strong nor that weak. Otherwise, you cannot explain, you know, some of the things that I'm going to discuss. So this book certainly tried to challenge these two extreme views and also argue U.S. should not lose this great opportunity, and we should engage with Xi Jinping, with his leadership. Otherwise, we'll really undermine American interests. And certainly that I want to access the so-called collective leadership framework. More importantly, try to find whether there's an institutional mechanism, and certainly I believe there's an institutional mechanism which really we basically fail to understand how endurable and how dynamic that mechanism And finally, forecast the upcoming 19th Party Congress. Now, talking about leadership change, I use that picture. Previously, seven members of the Politburo Standing Committee, Xi Jinping is the first among equal. But now, he's far more powerful than the other six in that leadership body. And he holds 13 top leadership positions, including many leading groups. And just a few days ago, he got another one. And it's called Central Military and the Civilian Integration Development Committee, just only three or four days ago. So altogether, he has basically 13 or 14 leadership positions. So this is called the concentration of power, in contrast to Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao era. And also that usually Mao, you know, towards the you know, later period of his life, they started this kind of work published. But Xi Jinping, in the first couple of years, already published his work. This is actually eight foreign languages. There's pictures, there's cartoons, all seem to echo what some liberal intellectuals criticize, the personality cut or cultural revolution style, with or without justification. But that's the things change over the past 4 years in contrast to Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao era. But some questions hardly addressed or inadequately addressed among the China study community in China and outside China. Here are the three questions I think we should pay attention. First, what caused this change? Secondly, how could this have happened? And finally, are these changes temporary or long-term? Of course, that my analysis will tell us that it's a short-term, it's temporary, could not be sustainable. This is certainly my argument. But let's look at the first two questions. What problem does this change, and how could this have occurred? Now, people tend to have short memory, including myself. Sometimes I just don't get what happened, like Bo Xilai, many other things, like the long history. But actually, just only 5 years ago. And before Xi Jinping came to power, let's look at what China looked like. There was a rampant corruption. There's a serious legitimacy crisis. And there's a fragmentation of the leadership, that each Politburo Standing Committee in control one department, one, you know, bureaucracy. This sounds like there's no communication, no coordination. And this is particularly in the case of uncontrolled power of Bo Xilai and especially Zhou Yongkang. And this is called, again, fragmentation. It's reached a very high degree. The Communist Party leadership almost become malfunctioning. And also PLA start to resist the civilian leadership. You know, during the Wenchuan earthquake, Wen Jiabao, you know, stood in front of the TV crying, begging military send the troops to the poverty relief, to the, you know, disaster relief area. But still, Guo Boxiong and the other leaders refused to take an order. And also the central government economic policy or orders were resisted by local government, local meaning provincial or municipal government. So this is a famous saying that the order cannot go beyond Zhongnanhai. And finally, foreign relations also experienced some problem as Zhi Zhongyun, a distinguished Chinese public intellectual who used to serve as a translator for Chairman Mao and Zhou Enlai. She said China, again, 4 or 5 years ago, she said China did not have friends except North Korea and Cuba. Now, that's the situation that Xi Jinping experienced. Of course, he needs to fix all these problems. Now, let's very quickly look at the corruption. This is the first biggest scandal related with the railroad ministry by the bureau chief, Zhang Shuguang, according to media in China and overseas, that that guy had $2.8 billion in his overshore bank account. Although the final, you know, prosecution report had a much lower price, but early on, that was the number frequently quoted. His boss, minister, we never seen how much he stolen from the state, but he has a nickname called Mr. 4%. And also that it's a common knowledge in China that the guy had 374 luxury housing units. Now, he's not a particularly attractive guy, look at the appearance, but he's extremely generous to give the woman. He had affairs, you know, one unit after another, you know, etc. So that's where 374 units came from. Now, the military guy, this is also the first card, Lieutenant General Gu Junsan, and he was in charge of logistics. And this is his villa built in his hometown in Henan, and they found four trucks of gold and the Maotai. It's expensive, and more expensive than gold, the Maotai Chinese liquid, but four trucks. These are all come to the public knowledge. Now, this is a famous crisis. I don't need to tell you about the Boxi Lai. Really, it's the biggest crisis probably ever in the PRC history. And this is another one. It's by Hu Jintao's chief of staff, Lin Jihua, which involved his son, who drove Red Floria. This is his wife, and also two Tibetan women. One of them was killed along with the driver, Lin Jihua's son. Now, these scandals or incidents, all in the Chinese domain, in Chinese public eyes. The most important one is these three. These are the highest ranking civilian and military leaders purge, and the Chinese call the biggest tigers. Now, this goes back to the other questions. How could this have occurred? Xi Jinping get rid of them and start to change. This is largely to do the fact that we still do not fully understand how that occurred, that all of a sudden he and Jiang Zemin, his patron, really had a landscape victory, landslide victory, and after the 18th Party Congress. I'm going to explain and in detail. Then also Xi Jinping launched a very bold and a big and broader anti-corruption campaign, the largest ever in the PRC history. He also started very successfully a large-scale military reform, although the military reform will take 5 years to complete. The most important part already completed within 6 months. And this is the reform that even Deng Xiaoping wanted to do but failed to do, but Xi Jinping achieved it with the support of the party. And also that in 2013, he at least outlined a very ambitious market reform plan. And finally, he adopted a so-called new proactive foreign policy, included the concept of new type of major power relations, largely referred to the United States, and also One Belt, One Road Initiative, and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. And also, as the Secretary Franklin mentioned, that his recent appearance in Davos reflects that China's ambition in the global affairs. Now, this is the background. This is explaining why it happened, how it happened. And let's look at the second thing that I pay attention. It's the methodology. It's the book really about the individual leader versus the institutional constraints, that the dynamic. Try to find the best balance in the Chinese context. But my sources usually from almost most of them from the official bio information, which I collected over the 30 years. But time to time, I also use non-official sources, but always verify in the book. And I do not use too many rumors, and especially we enter the rumor season. You can see basically get any kind of rumors. I mean, very, very sexy, many of them. And also that there's a balance between quantitative and qualitative research. But the emphasis of the book is on actually both, with a strong component of the analysis of 376 members of the 18th Central Committee, the current Central Committee. And finally, the book also used the Western series called the Elite Series, but tested in the concept I tried to develop, the notion I developed about 10 years ago called the One Party, Two Coalitions, borrowing Deng Xiaoping's famous line, One Country, Two Systems, to analyze Chinese politics. The basic argument is Chinese leadership China is a one-party state, but the Chinese leadership is not a monolithic group. It's consistent of competing factions, and factions form coalitions or camps, and this is, in a way, to a certain extent, similar to American, you know, two-party system, Republican and Democrat. Now, This is an organization chart. On the top is General Secretary Xi Jinping. Then it's a 7-member of Power Bureau Standing Committee. Then it's a 25-people Power Bureau. Then the 376 Central Committee. They were elected by National Party Congress delegates, 2,268. They only met once every 5 years. They met once to select these 376 Central Committee members. And finally, that the party has about 88 million members. Now, this part is the focus. It's the Central Committee. It's the one I focus about the 376. This is actually, if you want to have a political future, you should belong to that group. These people, this Central Committee, the Central Committee includes, you know, provincial party secretaries, governors, vice governors, ministers, vice ministers, senior military leaders, and the organization department, propaganda, and etc. Altogether, 376. Now, this is what happened 4 years ago in the 18th Party Congress. The yellow color, the new members, the blue are remaining members. In these six most important leadership bodies, Central Committee, Anti-Corruption Commission, Secretariat, this is in charge of daily flow of information or papers, and the Power Bureau, very powerful, 25 people, Power Bureau Standing Committee, and the Central Military Commission. In these six leadership bodies, you can see majority of them are new. That tells us that the very strong, you know, kind of a very dynamic flow of the Chinese leadership. Now, this has not only happened 4 years ago. This is a look at the Central Committee since 1982. On average, it's 62% change. Now, I'm always trying to find the percentage of our Congress, senators or congressmen. What I heard from staff is that it's probably less than 20% every 4 to 6 years. So China is a three time. China is no democracy, but the kind of circulation of the Chinese elites much, much faster. That explains how Communist Party survived over the years, how the party tried to remain, to be relevant, to represent certain interest groups, etc. Now, the upcoming 19th Party Congress, the red color, I estimate, will be 70%. This is based on each individual's calculation. Some of them, 25 of them are already purged, and some of them are already retired, and some of them do not look good. And so you end up with 70% change. Now, this will be the largest change since 1969 during the Cultural Revolution. So it's already happened in the local level. Hunan province, for example, there are 13 standing committee of Hunan Provincial Party Committee. 12 of them are new. This is certainly indicate what kind of scale change we can expect. Now, this is also the average tenure in terms of years of the provincial party secretaries and governors. These are very, very important positions. Later, I will continue to emphasize. The average tenure is very, very brief, very, very short. You know, provincial party secretaries usually serve only 2 years in their spot on average. The governors, it's even less. It's 1.5 years. This is, again, very fast turnover, extremely fast turnover. You probably cannot find this kind of turnover rate in any country, but China become almost regularized this kind of change. Some retire, some promoted, and some transfer to another positions. Now, this is all related with the institutional norm and the rules apply, and for example, age limit. Anyone who were born in or before 1944 will automatically disqualify for membership in the 18th Party Congress. 4 years before is 5 years before is 1939. You can expect that upcoming year is 1949. Anyone who were born 1949 or earlier will retire. Now, it's yet to see whether this norm will be changed or not. My sense is very, very difficult to change that norm. The term limits is not just norm, but the rules. So every leader could serve 2 5-year terms in the same position and 3 5-year terms at the same leadership of same level of leadership. For example, that if you are standing committee members, you can only stay there for 3 terms, even you change position, premier or general secretary. So that's the rule will restrain some leaders to go beyond, three terms or two terms, depending on the definition of the position. And also there's a regional representation. That's a very, very important development. That's really contributed to Chinese internal check and balance. During the Party Congress, each province will have four seats, two membership seats for the four members of Central Committee. Now, of course, after the Party Congress, they can rotate, they can change. But during the time, these 31 provincial level entities, each has two. And also there's elections going on in China. Almost for 30 years. It's a limited election. It's called more candidates than seats. For example, if they want to elect 376 Central Committee members, they will put 10% or more, 12% or more candidates. And those, the lowest will be eliminated. So that's the limited things. And sometimes people are considered for Politburo, for example, the former Minister of Commerce, you probably met and Chen Deming, he was considered as Politburo member, but he was eliminated in the election. So you must be Central Committee, then you're considered as Politburo. So you immediately disqualify. So that's the election could be quite effective in a way. Now, despite China's a lot of deficiencies in Chinese political system, we should not forget a couple of things. One is China already experienced not only once, but twice, largely orderly generational transfer of power, orderly and peaceful generational transfer of power. First from Jiang Zemin to Hu Jintao in 2002, then from Hu Jintao to Xi Jinping in 2012. And also not only generational change, but also occupational transformation of Chinese leaders twice. First from old-fashioned communists to technocrats, meaning engineer turned politicians. And then from technocrats to a more diverse group of economic managers, SOE entrepreneurs, and legally trained political leaders. This is some of the pictures of a transition. This is the study of the rise and the fall of technocrats. Again, in 1982, there was only one minister who meet the definition of technocrat, that was Li Peng, who later became premier. And there's no technocrats as provincial chief or governor. But then increased, then in later 1990s, reached a peak, then start to decline. This is a typical case of the rise and fall of technocrats in China over the past three decades. This is in the Central Committee, it's the same pattern. And look at high-level leadership. Even more so, this is the red color is the Power Bureau Standing Committee, and the blue color is the Power Bureau. Now it's only 16% to 14%. About 10 years ago, or so, in the so-called 14th and 16th Party Congress, all Power Bureau Standing Committee members are engineers by training. But now it's come to end. They're currently, in terms of highest degree, only one person, Yu Zhengsheng, has an engineering degree. And in terms of highest degree. So that's the pattern change. Meanwhile, there's a rise of those trained in social sciences and, believe it or not, in law. And blue color is the social sciences, red color is law in terms of the Central Committee members, four members. Of course, those in terms of law, there's a subgroup. I divided them. One is the only law degree in name. You know, actually, they study politics. Or study Marxism, according to Chinese definition, Marxism is a law, so therefore they have law degree. Now, but this is only the first category. The second is really legally trained, and really very much like a Western training, because the Chinese discipline of law is largely adopted by Western, by German, American, and Japanese models. China did not have the legal tradition. So these people receive this kind of training, but they never practice. The most obvious example is Premier Li Keqiang. He got a solid law degree at Beida, Peking University, but they never practiced as a lawyer. The third group is not only got a law degree, some of them actually overseas, and some of them not only undergraduate, but also advanced studies, but also practice and spend the entire career in the legal profession and in the court and and the prosecution and etc. So this is the last group. It's about 25%. So this is the division. Now, let me also very quickly move to the provincial leaders as a stepping stone for top leadership. As we know, China's top leadership usually selected by provincial leaders. You look at the 76%, about two-thirds of the power bureau members in the past two-party Congress are advanced from the provincial chief, governors, or provincial party secretaries. Now, it is interesting to see, this is I just completed just yesterday, because two or three days ago, some local government changed the leadership, like Beijing, Tianjin, and Shanghai. I was going to talk about this provincial leadership. But this is the leader serve in the business firms and the major companies, not the private firms. Private firms are still yet probably wait one generation for people like Jack Ma and to emerge as political leaders, but not now. He still need to wait. Even he met with Donald Trump before Chinese leaders. And these are the CEOs, major companies in space industry, many other in banks and the agriculture bank and the construction bank and etc. And these are the people really running firms, much like in the global competition. They are CEOs for many years, but now they are located as governors and even provincial party secretary. Many of them are still young. They can have two terms. So I will not be surprised in 10 years, a CEO, today's CEO, will become probably candidate for premier. And this will happen in about 10 years, probably. Now, let me very quickly mention that my basic theory is what I called one party, two coalitions. This could be controversial. I got a lot of criticism, but I still stay with my argument. Now, I'm going to go back to that. The one party, two coalition refer to two camps represent two different social, political, and geographical regions, not purely for the power, but also have local or institutional representation. These two coalitions are usually, though not always, equally powerful and tend to rotate terms in the driver's seat. And thirdly, they have different policy initiatives and priorities. They complement each other in terms of leadership skills and expertise. And finally, they compete with each other on certain issues but are willing to cooperate on others. The bottom line is they're in the same boat, and it's the same inspiration for China's rise and for survival of the Chinese Communist Party. Now, this is a divide into the formation of the two coalitions. I call them Jiang and Xi coalition. Now, that's the controversial part. Many people think that Jiang Zemin and Xi Jinping are engaged in vicious power struggle. Our journalists report that. I think this is terribly wrong. Now, Falun Gong, I saw some of our friends here, Falun Gong friends here, represent newspaper, also had the advertisement when Xi Jinping visited the United States about 4 years ago or so, that the New York Times advertisement saying wonderful things about Xi Jinping because they thought Xi Jinping will arrest Jiang Zemin. But that certainly is not going to happen because, of course, they have some differences, but they are very much on the same coalition. And sometimes there's some different views, but by and large, they come together. But the thing is, certainly not Falun Gong. And China study scholars, many people in China, outside China, believe these are infightings, but I do not see that. Yes, some of the people purge Jiang Zemin's proteges, but that's related to several things. One is bad luck. You really cannot protect something in bad luck. Sometimes it's outrageous nature. Sometimes for the common survival, you need to sacrifice for various reasons. This should go back case by case. So previously, it's the Shanghai Gang, the core group, now become princelings, the Taizidang, the core group, but included SOE entrepreneurs, urban leaders, coastal region leaders. But the Hu Jintao Li Keqiang Coalition has the same core. It's the Chinese Communist Youth League. This is by strict definition. Those leaders in the provincial and the central level of the Youth League who work under Hu Jintao when Hu Jintao was in charge of the Youth League, or under Li Keqiang in the 1990s when Li Keqiang was in charge of Youth League. You also actually eliminated some people actually closer to the other faction, but also advanced their career from Youth League. So when that kind of definition, you can distinguish the two groups. Now, interesting to see that 10 years ago, the number one and number two leaders in these six organizations, most important, powerful organization, one of each. And 10 years later, now, also look at these seven most powerful leadership bodies, including standing committee, number one, number two leader, presidency, president and the only vice president, state council is the premier or executive vice premier, central military commission, chairman, executive vice chairman. Again, all number one, number two come from two different coalitions. Now, this is the one I used 6 years ago, before Xi Jinping, before Bo Xilai's fall. You look at these important bodies. In the Politburo Standing Committee, only two members are fifth generation, who Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang, one of each. Only six of them considered as the fifth generation, three of each. Secretary and two of each. Vice Premier, altogether four, two of each. State Councilor, they're altogether five. One is the military. I deleted the military, two of each. Now, you can see this is coincident, but I think there's a structure tendency to divide this leadership into two coalitions to check balance each other. But what surprised people is 4 years ago, it's become imbalanced, largely because of some of the scandals that Jiang Zemin and Xi Jinping got landslide victory. This is 6-1 ratio. And this is Tuanpai leaders largely marginalized. But the next level, Power Bureau, is more evenly divided. But then you look at Central Committee. Among these 376 people, it's just opposite. This the Tuanpai Youth League. Yellow is the alternate members. Light blue is the four members. They had altogether the current party Central Committee, 96 members. Although probably like 12, 13 of them are recently purged. But when it's established, this is the largest faction. It's almost a quarter, a quarter of the Central Committee. But principally, it's the small numbers. Now, very quickly, go with the Youth League representation in top leadership bodies. You look at the Power Bureau, 24% of Youth League. Secretary, 42%. I mean, it's really quite well represented. Central Committee, a quarter, as I mentioned, the 96 people. State Council, 10 executive members, Premier, Vice Premier, and State Councilor, 40%. And Minister of State Council, 30%. Most well represented in provincial party secretary and our provincial governors. But the last two things start to change over the past 3 years. This is, again, provincial chiefs. You can see that the party secretary who are Youth League members declined from 45% to 16%. This reflects Xi Jinping's consolidation of power, very remarkable change over the past 3 years. Again, provincial chief is the most important stepping stone. You already see that Xi Jinping consolidated his power. And also in the governance, this change. Now, this is the newly appointed provincial chief, like a Beijing mayor, Shanghai mayor, Tianjin mayor. They are all Xi Jinping's confidant. These 10 people are relatively new. Many of them, particularly first line, they are all leading candidates for Power Bureau later this year. They are all work under Xi Jinping for many, many years. And in some cases, 30 years ago. Now they are well positioned to take over. Now let's look at my argument. I have time limits, I understand. Despite the continuing of the one-party state over the past three decades, the CCP has continually sought new mechanism, institutional regulations, political norms, and policy measures to resolve the inherent deficiencies for the sake of survival. And secondly, China's collective leadership model, with its internal checks and balances, is more dynamic and enduring than many overseas analysts believe, probably also more than the Chinese intellectuals believe. Finally, Xi Jinping's power and the legacy, which may better be assessed following the 19th Party Congress, will largely depend on whether he embraces the institutional political institutionalization in the governance of this increasingly pluralistic society. Because if he go against the trend, I think that he will experience some very, very difficult challenges, and because institutional norm and regulations is far enduring than we thought. Now, the focus in the 19th Party Congress still will be on the Power Bureau Standing Committee, not on the leading group. And this is 10 years ago, the change. This is the 5 years ago, the change, the Power Bureau Standing Committee. Now, just in several months, later this fall, five of them will retire. So who will be the replacement? There's a lot of big question mark. These are the leading candidates. And they are qualified in terms of age and based on their recent position and their activities. And it sounds like most of them will survive, will be strong candidates. But the tricky part is whether you will identify a successor or not. Previously, you know, after 5 years, you should identify a successor. But this is very unclear whether Xi Jinping will identify a successor, which means the so-called sixth-generation leaders. There are four people in contentious position, probably more, but at the moment, these four are identified, including two Power Bureau members, current Guangdong Party Secretary and Chongqing Party Secretary, but also two rising stars who very closely work with Xi Jinping, and the Guizhou Party Secretary and Jiangsu Party Secretary. The first two are not Xi Jinping's proteges. The other two are Xi Jinping's protege. Now, military also will experience major change. And among the 11 members, only two or three will stay on. So that will be the largest military turnover we can expect. Now, let's very quickly look at Xi Jinping's power base. He actually is uniquely positioned. Most of the other leaders just positioned in the either coastal region or inland region. But Xi Jinping reached out to both. And he is a princeling, represents the so-called second generation of communist red nobility, Hong Er Dai. But also he has strong ties with the so-called Shanxi Gan. And Shanxi is not only his father's, has strong family ties. His father pursued the revolutionary experience in that region and was born there. And Xi Jinping himself was a so-called settler youth during the Cultural Revolution for 7 years. Live in Shanxi. So a lot of his people promoted come from that period. But also he advanced his leadership in the provincial leadership, especially Fujian, Zhejiang, and Shanghai. And many of the proteges now in the fast move for promotion. Xi Jinping, as we know, also served as 2 or 3 years as the Mi Su, personal assistant to DOD secretary. That had made him have some connections with the military. And also, many of his Tsinghua classmates also on the fast move. And finally, he has a lot of Mi Su personal assistants. Now, I summarize, these are the rising stars. And start with Shanxi, Li Zhanshu, Zhao Leji, and Li Xi. Then in Beijing, his childhood friend Liu He will play a very, very important role on economic affairs. Chen Xi, his classmate, roommate at Tsinghua, will be promoted. Cai Qi is already promoted as Beijing mayor. Highly likely he will become Beijing party secretary. And He Lifeng, Wang Kunming, and Song Tao is currently ranked number 2 person in the foreign ministry, foreign policy establishment, only next to Yang Jiechi. And Chen Ming'er is mentioned Li Qiang, both from Zhejiang years. Now they are well positioned. And Yin Yong just recently appointed as Shanghai mayor. And in Shanghai, including Han Zheng, and Ding Xuexiang and Yang Shaodu currently just recently appointed a person in charge of supervision. These are the rising stars. But even all of them, as designated to Power Bureau Standing Committee and Power Bureau and the Secretary, they still only occupied 40 to 50% of these leadership bodies. They cannot take all these positions. So again, Xi Jinping has to share power. So let's look at the four scenarios. What we can see. There are four options. One is win the take all. Powerblue Standing Committee become Xi Jinping's personal cabinet, appoint you and you and you, maybe even disregard age or terms. This is one option. Second option is return to the so-called team of rivals, which means you should let some Tuanpai leaders to join the Powerblue Standing Committee. Thirdly, is downsizing the Powerblue Standing Committee, change 7 to 5, not allow any sixth generation leaders to enter that body, so which you delay the succession process to wait and see, and but also enhance the role of secretary. And finally, previously that Xi Jinping was weak in the Central Committee, but now Central Committee become 70% new members, many of them his proteges or like-minded people. He asked them to elect Power Bureau. Highly likely his proteges will be elected, and then he has a legacy as the man to start the new stage of the so-called intra-party democracy. Now, I don't want to go with the list, but the thing is, each of them involves some difficulties, involves challenges, but Xi Jinping need to address them. Now, previously, we see Xi Jinping is a man of contradiction in virtually every issue areas. You cannot make a generalization without somewhere a but, as you said, a but. For example, that on economic reform, he laid out the very ambitious the market reform, but he also a champion for state-owned enterprises, talking about making them bigger and stronger. And on the role of intellectuals, intellectuals are very critical about the media control, about the personality cut. But at the same time, Xi Jinping is a leader to want to promote think tanks. By definition, think tank is a place for intellectuals. Right. And on religious freedom, I mean, he's not so forthcoming with Tibetan or other religious issues, but we should not be surprised if the Pope will visit China someday in the near future. Right. And on the color revolution, certainly that's the things he strongly resists, but Xi Jinping is also a man who met with Burmese leader Aung San Suu Kyi, not only once, but I think 2 or 3 times. And this is a very symbol of color revolution. And also Xi Jinping's wife, First Lady, heavily engaged in NGOs, foreign NGOs, like tobacco controls, AIDS prevention, and women's rights, and children's rights, et cetera. On rule of law, as we know that human rights lawyers are arrested, and there's a lot of control, but at the same time, Xi Jinping devoted the one meeting in the state, the Central Committee meeting on rule of law. He probably more than any other leaders, try to adopt more regulations and laws and et cetera. And according to people very close to him, that Xi Jinping really want to leave some legacy in this area. Of course, at the moment, we see a lot of criticism. And on major power relations, he certainly wanted to improve relation with Russia, play around that China-Russia relation, but ultimately, he care more U.S.-China relations than anything else. Finally, that in Asia-Pacific security, one day he said Asia belonged to Asia. Then following week, he said Asia-Pacific is big enough to allow the United States and China both to be there. Now, with all these contradictions, he certainly wants to position himself. But at this point, in the early stage, probably it's a smart move for him. Sooner or later, he needs to make some decision. I think next 5 years will be very, very important. To end my presentation, let me quote. This is Chinese saying, but interesting enough that Xi Jinping used it last year and when he talked about Chinese leadership. This is a quote. Limited wisdom makes doers. Moderate wisdom makes managers. Superior wisdom makes law builders. Again, Xi Jinping used that term, just that quote, in 1 or 2 meetings recently. So, of course, we should test the next 5 years whether he really means that. And thank you very much. The book is available, and I will be happy to sign. Is that possible? I take some questions? Take a few questions. Yeah. Please.
Chris McRae, Norman McRae Foundation. I particularly like the last chapter of your book because I read it as giving a map of the next 2 years, which are maybe very critical both in China and the US, I was wondering, could you maybe make a list of the top five things on the agenda for Xi Jinping over the next 2 years? Obviously, you've mentioned the 19th Party Congress, and we've had the U.S.-America relations. What might be the other three be?
Well, China, like the United States, sometimes is driven by event. So unexpected event will drastically change his top priority. But assume that he could relatively control, I think, three things he will do. Number one, actually, is economic reform. At the moment, you know, if you buy my argument, he is really not firmly in control because that a lot of leaders are Tuanpai, Communist Youth League. They may resist certain policies. But after the 19th Party Congress, his people will be far more, far better positioned so he can carry out the economic reform that he actually not had been doing so well in the past few years. Now, someone said that Xi Jinping did not care about the economic reform. I don't buy that. Of course, for him, the priority is consolidate his power to pursue military reform. I mean, I think there's a legitimate reason for him to do so, without which he himself will be in big trouble. But if he does not care economic affairs, he will not, control all these positions, particularly economic leadership position. And so that means that he wants to make, you know, his legacy in this particular area. It is very, very difficult, but I think we will see that he will carry out a lot of reform program which are delayed. This is number one. Number two, again, he is not known as a political reformer. But on the other hand, he understands the importance of institutional development. Ultimately, his legacy will be determined by that. So whether he will pursue some institutional reform, and of course, that my view, he may not identify successor later this year, but it does not mean that he can resist any kind of arrangement. So how to make arrangement, I don't know. But I think that he must think hard. If you just refuse to take that, you not only your critics will go after you, even your allies think that you do not do a good service. So that's the thing's big challenge. Now, certainly he will have more control about the party, discipline them, establish more mechanism, but what kind of details yet to see. Finally, it's the international arena. You already see he's quite busy. He travels a lot. And he probably more than any other of his colleagues wanted to, you know, seize the moment to make China as a leader in certain areas. But of course, he need to be careful. He need to make sure that it's not unnecessary, you know, prematurely pursue that position. And so these are the three things I think his top priority. Yes.
I'm currently affiliated with the Tibetan NGO here. My question is, there's this speculation among Tibetan scholars that once Chinese Xi Jinping consolidated his power, there's a chance that he may not engage directly with Dalai Lama, but there is a possibility that he, remove some restrictions on religious and Buddhist stuff, because he mentioned Buddhism as one of Chinese civilization in Paris 2 years ago. So what do you think of that? Thank you.
Well, in general, I think that there's a strong tolerance about Buddhist activities. But Tibetan Buddhism is probably a different issue. And we certainly expected that for a long time, partly because his father actually had personal friendship with His Holiness Dalai Lama, right? And the Tibetan community thought that that's a great opportunity, but certainly we did not see any progress over the past 4 years. Whether he will make some move in this area, I do not see much evidence. But all depends on, because I do believe that probably from Chinese leadership perspective, you do see a lot of pressures. I mean, from their perspective, Taiwan, Hong Kong, now, I mean, Xinjiang, Uyghur issues, and Tibetan issues. These are all very, very difficult challenges. And whether he will make some move in certain areas, whether it's because of his success or because of his difficulties and the pressure, I do not know. I try to find a pattern that probably sometimes he would take initiative rather than under pressure. And but the dialogue, negotiation with the Pope, and that has been going on. It's become open, you know, whether he probably will go with that first, then to see the reaction. But on the other hand, that some of his people are famous for crackdown in the home church. And but at the same time, that you do see the other trend that you know, talk about some you know, Buddhism should be promoted and etc. So I cannot answer your question, but I do see that the framework and what you lay out so nicely. And the next few, yeah, the woman, yeah, the young girl.
Hi, this is Yi Jiachen. I have a question regarding your argument about the two, the one party to coalition argument, opposed to that there are a lot of turnover, about 70% for each, like, 4 years.
Central committee.
And now, another argument from me would be the quick turnover also push some incentives that those governors choose more short-term policies that may induce some short-term legacies for them because they only have 2 to 5 years, which cause some other like negative externality like the pollutants or other things. Would you think this is kind of incentive for them? Thank you.
Well, you're right. That's the problem. And that's why Bo Xilai wanted to plant grass rather than trees. Trees take many years, grass only one season. So that's tell you, that, you know, why they have, usually have short terms. In a city in Dalian, was a lack of water. Actually, you really need to have trees rather than grass. But he against that that plan for the reason that you point out. But let's face it, in our system, the election, and President Donald Trump said it's so long. I mean, he will say it's so long, but it's long. Also, a lot of distractions. So again, these governance issues, you know, each system has some problems. But the good thing is that they move around at the same position. They got to practice. China certainly have much longer period for training, for learning. And then some, all of a sudden, someone had no experience when they're promoted to very, very high level. And but at the same time, it's not transparent. It's not democratic in that way. So there's a trade-off. But your concern is legitimate concern, the short-term behaviors. Yeah. Yes, you.
Thank you. This is Beichang Wu with Shanghai Media Group. I have a quick question. Given your extensive knowledge of the leadership on both sides, do you think the two sides understand each other well enough? Like, does the Chinese side know well enough about the Trump's administration, and does the Trump administration understand well enough about the Chinese leadership?
Do we know Trump administration well? Do you expect the Trump administration know China well? Well, I think there are a lot of limitations. You have good questions. I think that in a way, previously, since 1970s, especially since established normalized relations in 1979, China and the United States have a lot of things going on, not in the top level, but also basically 100, 200, including some of my colleagues here. There's a lot of communications. But when Trump, when the White House, there's a really a huge gap. Chinese did not know who to call. And that could be very, very anxious and highly problematic. So at the moment, there are a lot of anxieties. And China is probably not the top priority for Donald Trump's team. But at the same time, I do believe that the administration understands the importance of China. And but there are some other urgent issues, both in the economic front and also security front. So I think it will take some time, and the whole team has not formed yet. And so far, as Secretary Franklin said, China's reaction has been cautious, not overreact. And that's probably smart on their part. But the question is, I mean, Chinese, just like we have a media, their media become increasingly critical. And some of the bottom, you know, red line issues like Taiwan and et cetera, if the administration, the top leader constantly push, will make Chinese more antagonistic. So that's the dimension we should look at that, right? There's a lot of, it's a new game. And but ultimately, I'm optimistic. I think that the fact is we don't have too many choices. And certain issues will be lose-lose. Certain issues will be win-win. Trade should be win-win. Taiwan issue we do not handle appropriately will be lose-lose. I mean, for all the parties. So again, I mean, this is not so difficult to imagine and for any leaders. We will take one more, then because we move to the next panel. There's so many experts. Yes, please, you haven't said. Yeah, wait so patiently. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm Mark Dowles. I'm professor of political science, and I'm at the sabbatical at GW. I wanted to ask about how you your one-party, two-coalitions idea. And you mentioned the idea that they're creating constituencies. And I want you to sort of explain what you mean by the constituencies. I mean, you've got the inland and the coastal and rural and urban. Are they actually representing in some way those constituencies? And also, if there's so much circulation, unless if their turnover is every 2 years, if they're not retaining jobs with that constituency, let's say internal to the inland area or not, then how do they actually build any kind of connection with those different groups?
Excellent question. It's how they build up largely because of your career, who promote you. That's the key. And usually there's no ambiguities who promote you. And also that we talk about the two coalition. Of course, there's some exceptions. You look at our country, Democratic and Republican, sometimes, you know, primary even more vicious, right? But also these factions, this coalition could change. Now, Tuanpai is certainly in trouble, but it's not completely gone yet, right? But even if not Tuanpai, some other forces will form coalition to try to constrain power automatically in a way because the seats are represented by different regions. And also there's some election mechanism. There's also tendency that all the other forces come together to try to contain some of power. And all these norms and the regulations, rules, actually are designed in a way to constrain power. Now, most interesting is the recent party meeting, the so-called sixth plenum. I thought they may not use the term collective leadership, actually use the term collective leadership. They talk about constraints of power. So again, compromise is necessary. At the moment, the party wanted to give Xi Jinping enough power to carry out much needed reform. Could you imagine without such power, he can do all these things, anti-corruption, military reform, and China's foreign policy change? No. But does that mean that he has a free, you know, empty check and do whatever he wants to do? No. The fact is, a lot of intellectual criticism itself is constrained, right? And you also should constantly deliver. And so it's a very dynamic situation. And so it's ever-changing. But at the same time, that kind of mechanism already has been used for the past 30 years. And China, just like us, become increasingly pluralistic. They face the same media problem. I mean, constant change. And so in that regard, I think certainly when I wrote that book, the criticism of American system is not that well known. I mean, even in you know, in the circle of Washington or the academia. And so let's certainly, when I write this book, I always constantly, you know, have sense of humility to appreciate more about the things, the experiments China wanted to do. You cannot say these things are completely hopeless. And I think they already found some mechanism. Now, these are not legitimate, some of the factional politics. It's not completely transparent. Although you ask a taxi driver, they will tell you which leader belongs to which faction, that the new appointment is whose person. So they're not in a complete dark. So that's also gave you the sense that you know, Chinese political structure, probably based on that, will continue to unfold in a way that the institutional mechanism will And it's already effective, will continue to be, you know, challenged or tested, and I hope that they will survive. So let me finish here. We have a wonderful panel. And really cannot assemble that the better people. These are the scholars or practitioners in their own right are prominent figure, but also they are leaders in government, in journalism, in academia. So please join me to welcome the next panel and moderated by Evan Osnar. Is he here? Okay. I hope that, so please come to the stage. And thank you so much for your attendance. Yeah. Okay. So good.
As soon as we get our band wired up, we will be ready to perform. We've got a few people coming in just in the back of the room, so I'd say we are ready to go. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the third and final segment of this morning's program. I'm Evan Osnos. I'm a non-resident fellow here at the Thornton China Center. And I think this morning you have already heard a number of valuable insights, of course, from Secretary Franklin, who reminded us of the value, the essential value of trade and leadership in this relationship. And then, of course, we heard from Cheng Li, whose absolutely fundamentally essential book, I think, reminds us that not only are the people at the top worth paying attention to, but we have to be looking at this relationship as a set of figures. So the people that they are surrounded by and the people who are beneath the top guys in this case are also important for us to understand. So we're just at the beginning of decoding what this administration in Washington will represent for the China relationship. And that brings us to this third, and I think I can confidently predict will be a very interesting and stimulating discussion from three very different vantage points. Before I introduce our panel in just a second, I just want to mention a couple of points of context that I think are relevant for framing this discussion, things from the near past. As Secretary Franklin mentioned at the outset, you sort of have to check your phone before you start talking about U.S.-China relations to see if anything's happened in the last 15 minutes. one point I want to mention is from yesterday, of course, when Donald Trump formally withdrew the United States, began the process of withdrawing the United States from the TPP. One of the reasons why this is important beyond just the explicit effects on trade in Asia and for the United States is that I think it should force us to revise what has become a bit of a conventional wisdom in Washington, which is the idea that perhaps we should take this administration seriously but not literally. I would argue with that and say perhaps we need to take it a little bit more literally than we have. And what you've seen in the early days is that many of the things that this administration campaigned on are in fact now becoming matters of policy. So it's perhaps useful to look at the record. The second point I would mention is that in the last week we saw Rex Tillerson, who's likely to be Secretary of State, talk about the U.S. posture towards the South China Sea in terms that we have not heard before. Yesterday, Sean Spicer, the White House spokesman, was given an opportunity to clarify, and he reiterated the idea that the United States will take some form of hardline position, perhaps, on the Spratlys. China, to this point, has been cautious in responding, though it did say yesterday that this is a matter of non-negotiable sovereignty. If that's the case, then we are in for that's going to be a substantive issue to deal with. And the third point I would mention is that over the last several weeks, we have seen that Xi Jinping was in Latin America, and at the time he was making deals that would bring in investment of $250 billion. He signed some 40 deals in all. So we're at a moment now where the United States, as we all know, is talking about building walls, and China is using this opportunity to project a very different message around the world. So that's some of the very complicated and I think uncertain foundation on which our conversation will follow, and we're fortunate to have a terrific group to help us do it. Beginning at the end, I'll introduce Richard McGregor, who was the Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times from 2011 to 2014. He led the newspaper's coverage of American politics after having served as Beijing Bureau Chief and Shanghai correspondent, so he knows both sides of the relationship. He is the author, I think, as many of you know, of The Party, The Secret World of China's Communist Rulers. In the middle, Dennis Wilder, who is one of our government's most esteemed analysts of China. He has advised various agencies. From 1995 to 2005, he was the head of China Analytic Studies and the director of intelligence, and went on to be the special assistant to the president and head of East Asia in the National Security Council, among other duties. He's now at Georgetown teaching on the subject of the PLA, and he is a senior fellow at the Initiative for U.S.-China Dialogue on Global Issues. And to my left, of course, is a friend to many in the room, David Michael Lampton, who is the Hyman Professor and Director of China Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, where he also heads up CICE China, which is a school's overall presence in Greater China. He's chairman of the Asia Foundation, and his newest book is Following the Leader, Ruling China from Deng Xiaoping to Xi Jinping. So we will start, if I may, Mike. You have the floor.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you all for attending, and thank Secretary Franklin in absentia at this point for her remarks, and certainly Cheng Li, you really deserve an enormous amount of credit for your intellectual achievement, not only in this book, but all your prior work. So you have, I think, all our admiration. I want to thank the Thornton Center and thank Evan and thank my colleagues here, and that'll end the formalities part of my introduction. A little background on my remarks, because we're all a function of what our latest experience and preoccupations are, and I've had an experience that's sort of shaping what I'm going to say here. I just got back from a trip to Vietnam, Indonesia, I will confess. It was to Bali to relax. So I don't want to hype that. But certainly China and Hong Kong. Indeed, I was in my hotel room in Hong Kong watching the inauguration. So I just got back. But it was interesting to be at this moment in various parts of Asia. And certainly I'm going to focus on what Asia seems to be thinking about China. But I would just flag the issue of what Asia is thinking about the U.S. is a very interesting question as well. I was interested, it's been expressed several ways, the U.S. is building walls, or at least talking about building walls. China's building railroads. And I'm doing interviews on the building of connectivity between Kunming and Singapore by three different routes, and I'm interviewing in all the countries there. And this economic leverage that China has, and the power to forge cooperation by virtue of its having a vision, I think can't be underestimated. So I'm working on a book with that with two colleagues, one from Singapore, one from Malaysia. So in any case, that's why I was in Asia, and that will shape what I have to say. I guess I want to make two broad points and then a third, I think, fairly telegraphic point on Taiwan. Point one really deals with the reaction to the election of Donald Trump and the aftermath of his election in China. And secondly, second broad point is regional reactions to U.S. foreign policy and the evolving U.S.-China ties. Point one, that is to say the Chinese reaction to the election of Donald Trump, I'd make a couple of points. One is it strikes me that we've seen the Chinese in very rapid succession move what I would call through the four stages of buyer's remorse. What struck me is when I went to China just before the election is how many people entertained with great equanimity the idea that Donald Trump would be elected. Some thought he was a businessman, would be pragmatic. They know how to do business negotiations. This is the kind of guy we can deal with. I think that was a very prominent one. There was a subset that was much darker, and that is if, in fact, he is serious about what he's saying, this will be, in a way, a windfall for Chinese foreign policy because it's going to create vacuums all over the place which we can fill. But either way, the initial predisposition, at least to the people I was talking, was at least equanimity, if not a kind of welcoming idea at the thought of Donald Trump. This was compounded by a set of attitudes I won't go into about Secretary Clinton and her whole experience dealing with China. But they reinforced and went to a sort of positive. I say that rapidly after the election really began to sort of switch towards what I would call concern. And that concern had certainly got its initial impetus with the telephone call with the president of Taiwan and president-elect Trump. But also, I think the Chinese were almost immediately surprised that the rhetorical level didn't drop. As Secretary Clinton was saying, he seems to be serious about what he was saying. I think the Chinese tuned into that very rapidly. I think this concern then rapidly morphed to what I would call high anxiety, and that was when they began to see the personnel appointments, or at least the rumors, followed by nominations, followed now by testimony. I think this has really boosted their concern, and we just mentioned the Tillerson remarks, but certainly Peter Navarro at the National Trade Council. The Chinese are fully capable of going to YouTube. Even the citizenry can't get it. They can look at all the YouTube videos by Mr. Navarro and get the picture very rapidly. So I think that it morphed to high anxiety, and now I would say it's growing alarm. And there's sort of symbolic of that is the whole discussion now of the utility or applicability or whatever you want to say about the one China policy, or as the Chinese would say, the one China principle. Then, of course, the issue that was just alluded to about denying access to China's occupied artificial islands and other claimed sovereign territory in the South China Sea. So I would say it's almost striking how rapidly the Chinese have reassessed what seemed to me to be a rather benign view prior to the election. The Chinese, so that's sort of one response, is just sort of how they're trying to process this. The second category of response, it seems to me, is China moving into what I would call a whole set of at least perceived, if not actual, power vacuums. And certainly one of them is just assuming the rhetorical historic mantle of the United States posture on globalization. It's almost Xi Jinping at Davos sounded like Robert Zoellick in 2005 talking about the responsible stakeholder, almost in a sense implicitly lecturing the United States about responsible global public goods and so forth. Secondly, it seems to me the Chinese are pushing into the. I want to say one thing. We've given Mr. Trump the pulling out of TPP, killing TPP, what all. But in fact, this is a murder victim with a lot of knives in its back, TPP, right? I mean, it wasn't going anywhere in a sense, no matter what Mr. Trump did. But he certainly embraced that. But China is now pushing RCEP, and over the weekend you see Australia and Japan getting together, the prime ministers talking about how they're going to relate to RCEP, their hopes that somehow something out of TPP can be salvaged, a lot of things going on there. But China is moving very rapidly into the multilateral trade cooperation sector that they see abandoned by the United States. We see China also wooing, I will say, allies and quasi-allies of the United States, and I would point just as three examples, the Philippines, Thailand, and Malaysia. They each have their own checkered history with both China and the United States, but clearly China's working on what you might call the non-core elements of the U.S. alliance and friendship system in Asia, and I think having considerable influence. And that's why I bring up the railroads and investment. The amount of economic leverage China's able to exert in this area is considerable. And you're going to see a railroad from Singapore to Kunming going right through Laos, Thailand, Malaysia to Singapore in the next 10 to 15 years, I'm pretty certain. And that's then going to force other infrastructure involvement and so forth. And one of the core questions for the U.S. is, are we going to be involved in this, or are we going to be bystanders? And this is going to have economic consequences as well as, geopolitical. Certainly another way we see China responding to this is China's ratcheting up the pressure on Taiwan. And I'm glad to deal with that, as I'm sure my colleagues are. But clearly the pressure is going up on Taiwan, not just because of Mr. Trump, but certainly Madam Tsai Ing-wen has a role in this whole thing. And indeed, domestic Chinese politics does. Now, so that's where I would say China's had a lot of reactions to what's happened. The other thing that I wanted to talk just briefly about is the regional reactions to the election of Trump and to Chinese behavior. One thing came through to me is, as I started by saying, I think the region is almost as worried about us as it is about China. And if you don't believe me, just look at the reporting and interaction between the Australian Prime Minister Turnbull and Abe, and look at the conversation they have about the emerging power configuration in Asia. I suppose that you could look at it in a number of ways, but Japan and Australia are up in their security cooperation, partly because of uncertainty about what the U.S. role is going to be and what is the emerging direction of U.S.-China relations. I think if you look to Northeast Asia and you look at Japan and South Korea, they're alarmed about the potential for use of force on the Korean Peninsula. Of course, they're not happy with North Korea, but they're not happy with the prospect of a unilateral U.S. forceful intervention. Let me just conclude with a few comments on Taiwan, because I think this is really the deal buster in the whole relationship. And I would like to share, and I do on the economic side in some sense share Secretary Franklin's optimism, but when I look at the emerging Taiwan situation, I find it rather difficult to be overly optimistic. First of all, it seems to me clear Taiwan does not want to be used as a bargaining chip in some larger geopolitical game. So Taiwan is even ambivalent about the way things are going on. Second, I would say tweaking China on the one China policy, or what China calls the one China principle, is really, to use the cliche that came out in 1950 prior to China's intervention, is playing with fire. And I mean, I actually think it's just that important in the Chinese political system. Thinking that Beijing will negotiate on the one China policy, I think, quite frankly, is fanciful. I may be wrong, and I maybe have listened to China for 40 years and incapable of thinking anything different, but I think it's a fanciful thought to think they will negotiate on that, I would say at any time, but certainly in the run-up to the 19th Party Congress and everything it means for China's future. Being weak on Taiwan is not where you want to be at this moment that Cheng Li was describing. It seems also to me that Taiwan is likely to bear the brunt of the initial Chinese retaliation, whatever it may be, and we're already seeing some of that in the economic tourism and certainly diplomatic isolation and so forth. And finally, I would just call I think at this moment it's well to remember history. And if you think of 1950 and the Korean War, you sort of think of 1962 on the Indian border. You think even in 1979 in Vietnam, When the Chinese used force, it came as a surprise to most of the people on the receiving end. And I think China is still capable of surprise. And so we've got to be careful. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, that's terrific. Dennis, over to you.
Thank you. First of all, let me thank Chung Lee and Brookings for inviting me today. Terrific occasion. Couldn't be more topical, couldn't be more to the point. Let me take a little, I'm going to try and be optimistic because I fear we're all getting ourselves now spiraling down and down into the mud here, and it's pretty ugly. So let me try and just be a little more optimistic. First of all, I was very much involved in the Bush administration, and I remember the beginning of the Bush administration. I remember the fights between, and I viewed some of these, between Donald Rumsfeld and Colin Powell over China policy. There could not have been two more polar opposites. There were a lot of voices at the beginning of the Bush administration who felt they had the answer. And eventually, the President of the United States had to figure out where he wanted to take the relationship. And as you may recall, 9/11 occurred. He went to Shanghai for the APEC meetings. And he, which I think was already his inclination, to be honest with you, but he realized that having the Chinese on side was more important than some of the issues that some of the others had mentioned to him. Well, I'll just tell one quick story just to and this is Steve Hadley's story, the former National Security Advisor to President Bush. You remember early in 2001, perhaps, that an ABC News reporter asked President Bush, would you defend Taiwan if it was attacked? And Bush said, well, of course I would. He saw that the reaction was very strong to this immediately as he said it, and he turned to Hadley afterwards and he said, did I say something wrong? And Steve Hadley said, well, you've blown away 20 years of strategic ambiguity. So, you know, there are these problems at the beginning of an administration where you come in, you have some views, but they're not terribly well-founded, and we may be seeing some of this at this point. That all said, I think that China has to accept that Trump is a discontinuity of 36 years of American foreign policy toward China. Through most of this period, Democrats and Republicans held relatively similar views on how to deal with China. We had some differences, but I don't think they were nearly as great as the differences we now have with Trump. And I think that China has got to see that the American public, the American consensus has shifted. And it is not just Trump. It's the Democratic Party, and there is the feeling that the trade situation, the way the trade has been structured between the United States and China, has advantaged the Chinese ordinary citizen more than the ordinary citizen in the United States. There's been a tremendous amount of growth and wealth in China. We know the emergence of the middle class. But you look at the middle class in the United States, and they worry for jobs for their children. Yes, China has brought them cheap goods, but if you don't have a job, buying cheap goods at Walmart doesn't really make much difference to you. And so I think China needs to understand that there was a lot of enthusiasm, as was talked about with the third plenum and the third plenum document. And I think American business was very optimistic at that point in time, and David Dollar and others have written on this. But it quickly became apparent that for whatever reasons, and Chung Lee has given some of them today, perhaps, there was not the follow-through on that. And as we were opening up to China, after all, last year, what, we took $51 billion worth of investment in American companies. China didn't do the same. There was a lack of reciprocity in a new period of time when China was a much greater power. China had become the world's leading trading partner for the world. And so I think Americans in general feel it's time for a recalibration, that we need to find a new place to be. Now, there's been a lot of talk about Trump and tariffs and other things. To me, I think what Trump is trying to do is find some new levers. I think that he feels that the Obama administration really had no levers in dealing with the Chinese. And as a negotiator personality, he knows you need levers if you're going to get a better deal. So I wonder whether some of this talk of trade adjustment, taxes, and other things is to build the kind of leverage he thinks he needs. So I really think that Beijing needs to think about how to move forward on the economic reforms. I'm a little worried about Cheng Li's presentation, because if I accept his line of argument, we're on two different timelines. The administration wants to see something soon, and Xi Jinping wants to wait until after the 19th Party Congress. That's going to be a problem, because I think for China, I would argue, and I have talked to Chinese about this, I think China needs to move fast. Mexico is going to move fast. Canada is going to move fast to work a new deal with the United States. I think it's incumbent on China to figure out a way to put some, if you will, gifts on the table, show some willingness to reconsider that part of the relationship. The other part of the relationship that just has to have recalibration at this point, there is no way around it, is on North Korea. China can't, and the U.S. both, are running out of time and running out of room to figure out a way forward on this problem. I do take, as Evan said, very seriously what President Trump said, that he won't allow the North Koreans to possess a capability to strike the United States with nuclear weapons. I think that is a serious statement, and one that we need to look at. I would also agree that a military showdown in Northeast Asia, it would be horrendous, would be a horrible thing. So the question is, how do the United States and China find some sort of way to move the North Korean situation to a better place? Obviously, that will involve negotiation, but I also think that China's reluctance to go too far with sanctions over time has allowed the North Koreans to calculate that they're really never going to get that kind of pressure on them from the Chinese. And this is very different from the Iranian situation, where the sanctions were imposed by the international community in a very coordinated and tough manner. I am not as convinced that China has sent that signal, simply because I don't see any indication that the North is at all worried about its situation. So I think this has got to be recalibrated. The third recalibration is a tougher one, and I'm not sure I have a lot of answers for it, but it's the military-to-military side of the U.S.-China relationship. It does involve the South China Sea. China's military is going global. There is a fundamental change from first was a brown water navy, then you had sort of a green water navy, now we're in a blue water navy. And Djibouti is just the beginning, I'm sure, of Chinese attempt to create logistics bases and other things overseas. This means that American and Chinese military forces are going to come into geographic proximity to each other much more than in the past. I don't think we've gotten to a point of transparency where we deal with that very well. While I'm glad to see that we resolved in a day the issue of the underwater drone that the Chinese picked up in the South China Sea, that was clearly a very odd incident in that it occurred outside of Chinese waters. And therefore, you know, could be perceived as an illegal activity. So I think that we're not there on the military side. We have some hotlines. We've done some work in this area. But I think a lot more discussion of confidence-building measures and understanding of each other's operations is going to be needed. One quick final point. You know, I've heard Chinese express the view, you know, perhaps a little jubilantly, that the United States is now a divided nation. And I'm certainly not going to sit here and try and tell you that on social issues we are not divided, as the march on Saturday certainly exemplified. Obviously, on some key domestic issues, we're very divided. But I would be a little careful of carrying that conclusion into the international sphere. I think there's a strong, as I said, view in the United States that the China-U.S. relationship needs recalibration, and that we have to find a way to solve the North Korean problem. And I think a strong U.S. presence in East Asia, both military and economically, is something that Americans clearly understand is in their interest. And a good relationship with China, I would also say, is understood to be in our interest.
If that's the optimistic take, then we've got a long way to go. That was superb and much needed. Richard, thanks for that, Dennis. Richard, over to you.
Thank you. I'm going to talk a little bit about the CCP and economic policy under Xi Jinping. I just want to bounce quickly, though, off a couple of points by Professor Lambton, which I think are pertinent today. It's fascinating to hear about the railway linking Singapore to China. I can remember, I'm old enough actually to have lived in Southeast Asia in the 80s and 90s, and you used to see those sort of Florida-style drawings with palm trees on it, this sort of mythical railway linking Southeast Asia, and frankly, it's going to be a reality. And, you know, with the U.S. internally preoccupied, the sorts of things that we've talked about in good and bad ways, so-called Asia for Asians, got a very bad name in the 30s. A lot of people were very frightened when Xi Jinping talked about it himself. It had a sort of nasty racial edge in the 80s and 90s when Mahathir used to talk about the East Asian Caucasus, you know, the Caucasus without Caucasians and the like. But if you see this sort of way that the region is just being knitted together economically, it's really going to give greater political impetus to regional institutions, which may not exclude the U.S., but will probably marginalize the U.S. in some way. So that's fascinating. And the second point about a Taiwan crisis this year, I know, you know, that I think the people in the U.S. will always tell the Chinese with good reason, this is our political season, don't do anything silly now. I mean, China has a selection year, not an election year, but I do believe things are much more sensitive, and you can get a very good idea of that from looking at what happened in 2012 between Japan and China when they had their last fight over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands. And really, the bilateral relationship has never recovered since. I mean, there's another dynamic happening there. But this is the absolute worst time to dump a sensitive issue into the internal politics in Beijing. So let's talk a little bit about the economy, some of the issues touched on here, economic reform and the like. And about the different ways to judge how well Xi has done on economic policy or how poorly he's done, and the different kinds of benchmarks we might use, both internal and external. I mean, I think ultimately Xi's legacy will be determined by how well he does on the economy. You have a successful economy, it helps in just about everything, managing social stability, foreign policy, paying for all the military hardware that the PLA wants, the funding for, you know, government programs, particularly pensions with the demographic collapse coming. But I think it's also the area where Xi has been least active, least confident, and I would say least successful as well. You know, in other words, where he's really, in Western eyes at least, really grievously fallen short of his promise. So let's have a look at where CCP politics and current economic reform debates intersect. I think the argument you hear from some in China is that, you know, she's subordinated economic reform to party consolidation. And the argument is in favor of, you know, party reform and a cleaner communist party basically later lays down the tracks for more substantive and genuine economic reform. It's the same kind of argument you hear about the anti-corruption campaign, that somehow this is magically going to morph in his second term into, you know, genuine legal reform. Leaving aside that on the economic policy front there's little evidence of that, it's not clear to me that the kind of economic consolidation that she has undertaken so vociferously in his first term bodes very well for economic reform in any case, whatever the sequencing may be. If in fact we agree, I don't think everybody in China agrees, if we agree that liberalization in some form is what China's economy needs, then I think party consolidation, particularly the kind of party centralization that Xi Jinping has imposed, I think instinctively pushes the debate in the other direction. All the sorts of powers that Xi has been able to use as General Secretary in his first term, personnel changes in the military, reorganization of the military, which in fact he did, I think, just before the Taiwan election, which I think shows remarkable confidence in that area, the enhanced role for the anti-graft policy, the way he's marginalized Li Keqiang and the State Council, it's probably the weakest State Council in a generation. All of these are tough decisions, and they look from the outside to be tough decisions, but they also allow Xi to pull the levers of power that he has at hand as party secretary. And he can't do that with the economy, which is, you know, a vast, complicated, and globally integrated economy. It doesn't respond to threats. You know, it doesn't respond to people being locked up except in the marginal sense of fiscal policy. And the interest groups can't be managed in the way that personnel in the party can be managed. And so I think in that respect, you know, the economy is a much harder nut to crack. And it's one that really, you know, that she not only hasn't been so active on, but doesn't really have the easy tools at hand that he does on party consolidation. What about, as Cheng Li was talking about, the sorts of personnel changes we're going to have in the second term? Let's assume, for example, that Xi does get his way, not just in the standing committee, but way beyond that, in all the sorts of areas that Cheng Li was talking about, where you've got the China Youth League, in theory, still in charge at the provincial party level, provincial governorships and the like. That kind of assumes that, well, once Xi, you know, he's already meant to be the most powerful leader since Deng Xiaoping. What does he want to do now? And that kind of assumes that we know he's got a master plan for the economy, that the third plenum rhetoric about a central role for the market is genuinely held. And I think that so far we don't really know what he wants to do once he gains even more power in the party. And the sense, my sense from, you know, that there's not some inner entrepreneur in any case waiting to jump out of, you know, Xi Jinping's skin once he gets a real lock on all the positions. And I think that's one of the great mysteries of the second term, what he in fact wants to do with the economy and whether in fact he can be successful. A couple of other points. You know, the coming collapse of China has been a theme for many, many years. It hasn't happened. I doubt it's going to happen. I do think the system is pretty resilient, and I think the system is resilient enough to have, you know, basic economic stability. I don't know what's going to happen, when there'll be a financial crisis, when the chickens will finally come home to roost on debt and the like. But you can also look at the Chinese economy in recent years, and this is not anything of Xi's doing, where the metrics are much better, both from a sort of Western perspective and a Chinese perspective, or Chinese Communist Party perspective, if you can delineate the two. First, I think we've now had five consecutive years in which the services and consumption have been bigger than the industrial output. That amounts to something. From the Chinese perspective, I think there's a couple of ways in which one particular way in which you can judge Xi's stewardship to be much better than it appears from the outside. If you look at the way, you know, the party's desire to sort of boost comprehensive national power, as they call it in China. Obviously, the military, I think, is a way that that's gone up substantially, and that's not really just because of Xi. I think he's got a lot, Dennis will correct me, but he's got a lot of hardware coming online that's been coming down the tracks for a long time. So China can use military signaling in a way that they could never do before. But the other, on the economy, and I think the other aspect of comprehensive national power is the accumulation of technology, whether that's homegrown technology, whether it's because China has begged, borrowed, and stole it, or developed it, or been had it handed over to them by guileless foreign investors and the like. There was a fascinating statistic in a recent IMF report. I think this has been reported. And to Professor Lambton's point about Asia, this is a report on China and the CMLV region, which was a put me on a learning curve. That's a new area. That's the Cambodia, Myanmar, Laos, and Vietnam economic zone. They had this interesting statistic. Basically, processing trade, which, you know, everything sort of being that China is the final assembly point. That used to be about half of Chinese exports. Now it's only about a third of Chinese exports. And if you look at the domestic value-added ratio of Chinese exports, they now actually exceed South Korea and Taiwan. And I thought that was a real sort of benchmark. And it just shows you how, I think, well China is doing in accumulating technology by whatever means. And that's the sort of benchmark that I think, you know, that would, she would be judged internally on very, very well. Just one final point, which Cheng Li talked about as well, about institutionalization, about Xi being in favor of institutionalization. I personally don't see any evidence of that. One of the most remarkable things about his time in power is I think that he's made an already opaque system even more opaque, a tightly held system even more tightly held. And all the sorts of things that Cheng Li enumerates so well in his book about the norms and rules and conventions, and they are separate things, I agree with him that if they start to be overturned, starting with the Party Congress this year, there will be a really big backlash against that, because that's been one of the keys to China's successes. Underrated, two peaceful transfers of power, and if you start undoing that, I think it could be very dangerous. Finish there.
Thanks, Richard. One of the things I think that comes through as you hear these three presentations is how much the conditions on the ground on both sides of this relationship have changed faster than the other side has been able to perceive it. So, for instance, if you talk about the economy, Richard points out that you now have a pretty large service sector in the economy, which is generally not reflected in the political conversation, in the sort of top-line political conversation in the U.S., where we're still talking about currency as if it was 3 or 4 years ago. Dennis makes the point, I think, absolutely right, that the Chinese perception of where the U.S. public is obsolete. Because the U.S. public is, in its sense, kind of ripe for a moment of change. And then, of course, Mike, I think, is making a huge point about the idea that the One China policy or principle, if that is regarded as a negotiating or a bargaining chip by our incoming administration, then they are dealing with a different playbook than the people across the table will be, who regard this most likely, I think, as an item, a non-negotiable item, certainly. So what I identify that fact because I think it points to this underlying issue, and I wonder if I'm sure you will all have thoughts that would reflect on each other's comments. But before we turn to the audience, I have one question that I thought would be interesting to explore, which is that if you look at Henry Kissinger last year said that we are at a moment now, he's no alarmist, I would say, on the U.S.-China relationship, but he said last year that we are at risk right now of being in a situation in which we have tremendous interdependence, but we could find ourselves ambling into a confrontation. I'm paraphrasing here. Ambling into a confrontation, nevertheless. And it gets to the, in a sense, the predicament that we're in, which is that in the beginning of the modern U.S.-China relationship, you had a consensus. And the consensus was you were unified, essentially, against the Soviet Union. Later, we had a new kind of consensus, which was the idea that there was this win-win relationship to be had over trade and economic interdependence. And now I wonder, we're into this phase, and I don't yet know how to describe this phase. And the question I guess I would sort of generally pose to you, but by all means take it any direction you want, is whether or not we have at the moment a consensus in the relationship that is recognized on both sides, that is operative, and that can form a basis for cooperation or at least conversation at a period where there is so much turmoil and uncertainty. So, Mike, if that's a jumping off point or anything you want to comment on the others, I think we've got a few minutes before we turn to the audience.
Well, I guess several things come from your comments and reaction to my colleagues. First of all, I thought Dennis had a superb point that, I mean, the relationship does need to be recalibrated, certainly in the minds of, a vast majority right. of Americans. And that the way in which it would be recalibrated is in the direction of something, the complicated term legally, but reciprocity. Just, of course, China's five times as big as we are, and so what would equate to an equal or more equal relationship isn't so easy to define. Yeah. But nonetheless, politically, it's important to think there is a relationship that's going in a more equal, fair, balanced direction. I think that's and you could build a consensus, getting mm-hmm. your question, about that. I would say that the economics is the core, but I would say that lack of reciprocity is not limited to economic realm. And I'll just give a couple of examples, I think there are a lot more. Media relationship. Mm-hmm. What would you, Evan, say about the relationship between China having, well, we'll say hundreds, if not low thousands of media right. people here, and our major daily journals have trouble getting visas to China and on a pretty short leash when they're there. So just that whole realm, and I'm always amazed, incidentally, how journalists seem to be nervous about doing anything about that or having the government act on their behalf. Certainly in other areas, just visa reciprocity. China's America watchers and intellectuals have 10-year visas, bingo, no questions asked, as I understand. I think we're getting under a much tighter visa requirement to get into China, just for examples. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we could make a list, but this reciprocity is in a broader area. We find research in China limited, but in limited numbers of Chinese scholars asking to come and spend a year researching the United States and so on. And I've spent my whole career favoring that mm-hmm. kind of thing, and I still do, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. But the point is this reciprocity is nine at the foundation of this relationship. On your Kissinger comment, ambling into conflict, I guess the import of what I was saying is I'm afraid of that as well.
Yeah.
And I think you don't have to hypothesize where the ambling may be occurring, but certainly the South China Sea would seem to be one area. I mentioned Korea, and so mm-hmm. did Dennis there. And then I must say I'm a little more, I hope, and I think there's some prospect that Secretary Barbara Franklin could have been, correct that reason will prevail in the economic relationship. I must say, though, I am more worried about ambling into a trade conflict than I detected she was. So long and the short of it is, I think, and that gets to a point, you said, well, we ought to take some solace. George W. came in with an agenda, and look, he sort of got, through events and through maybe his own inclination. But he had Hadley around him. He had Colin Powell around him. He had his father, mm-hmm. right? So if I look for what I would call the intellectual safety net, I'm a little more worried.
Dennis,
couple very quick thoughts. One is that, I think Dai Bingguo is the one who always loved to say we're in the same rowboat together, the United States and China. Mm-hmm. There is a rowboat we are in together, and that is this
profound changes of our economies in the 21st century. The cyber age, some people call it. Some people call it the fourth industrial revolution. We are both going to struggle with the robotics changes in our countries. We are both having trouble figuring out where the jobs will come from in the future. You know, we look at the driverless car. An entire part of the American economy, trucking, is going to change, and not for the better in terms of the number of jobs available. So, and I think China has the same issue. They're, if you look at their factories, their major factories, they're all talking about downsizing. And so I think this is an area where if we can be constructive with each other, we need to figure out how we're going to make people's lives prosperous and productive in a very different age. Second point I would make is the Trump team does need to have the discussions internally, get their act together internally, figure out what kind of going-in position they're going to have with China. I also think it's very important, and I am a great believer in what Hank Paulson did in the Bush administration. I think you need a point person. I think it is vital that some cabinet-level official be designated on the Trump side to begin this process. Because if we're going to have all these competing voices with the NTC and USTR and the Secretary of Commerce, you know, I actually feel for the Chinese trying to negotiate with a system that has that many voices. So I would really recommend that they figure out how to make some sort of clear delineation of who's going to handle the economic account.
Somewhere in Beijing, there's a PowerPoint that looks like the opposite of what Cheng Li had up there, trying to make sense of the new faces on the U.S. side. Richard?
Yeah, I'd just say, none of us know what will happen, obviously, but I think, you know, Trump's core campaign pitch was about the economy rather than the South China Sea and the like. That seems like more of an afterthought for him. I've done a lot of work lately looking at the trade wars between the U.S. and Japan in the 80s. I think a lot of us forget what an intense period it was. All sorts of incredible, the Plaza Accord, a massive revaluation of the currency, voluntary restraints by the Japanese on exports. At one stage, Reagan put 100% tariffs on semiconductors. On an issue the Pentagon got on board on with the USTR and the like. But, of course, speaking of safety nets, there was always the US-Japan alliance, which was under that and kept it contained. And I think the opposite is the case with China. So that's pretty scary. And I guess the other point with that, I feel that the Chinese are able to endure more pain than Americans. Or Europeans or whomever, because it won't be isolated. And I guess one of the problems with that, and Mr. Trump may learn this and maybe he won't care, but a trade war with China is a trade war with Asia. And that was a really big issue for the U.S. in handling Japan in the 80s. They got a lot of pushback from their Asian allies. And I think that makes it even more difficult to manage.
We're in a few moments, we're going to turn to the audience for questions. But before we do, Dennis, I had one sort of specific question about the military and the civilian leadership, which I think runs through this broader question of how will China respond if there is a moment of crisis. Do you have a feeling these days for the degree to which the civilian and military leadership, how they're responding to each other, whether in fact the military is in its proper place in the Chinese conception, that it is, in fact, remains loyal and subservient to the civilian leadership?
First of all, the changes of Xi Jinping on the military side are probably the most dramatic of anything he has done. No one in Chinese history has really gone through the military the way he did on the anti-corruption campaign, the cleaning out of the officer corps, and now the restructuring of the military district or military regions into theater commands. This is an enormous change for the PLA. And I think that right now there are I'm sure, ground forces, land forces officers in China who are feeling the pain of this because they have lost a bit of their authority in the system. On the other hand, those who want a more professional military are probably very excited about these changes. We just had the Navy officer selected as the head of one of the theater commands, the Southern Theater. That is unprecedented. Never happened before. The ground forces always dominated because the ground forces came from the revolutionary period. So I think Xi Jinping actually is in a much better place today in terms of controlling the PLA than certainly Hu Jintao was at the end of his administration. I always felt that Hu Jintao never really figured out the military relationship. But Xi Jinping's background gave him this opportunity. I think Cheng Li talked about him serving with Geng Biao in the early 1980s. He understood something that Deng Xiaoping understood as well, and that is when you're going to consolidate power, you better consolidate the security services and the military very quickly. And he learned that lesson, and he's put it into effect. And I think, as far as I can tell, pretty comprehensively.
Yeah, that's encouraging. Okay, well, I think there's going to be a lot of questions here. I would remind you only, please, to identify yourself, wait for the microphone, and also to try to keep your question short, and rather than a comment, make it a question. We'll start right here. Yeah.
Hi there, Verinda Fike with the U.S. Trade and Development Agency. You spoke briefly about some of the U.S. Domestic issues and how the China perception is that we have some divisive issues at home that may preclude us from being a responsible stakeholder, to use your words. China also has some inhibiting factors domestically, whether it's pollution or job creation or rebalancing their economy, just to name a few. I was wondering if you could speak to some of those factors as being perhaps inhibiting factors for them being a more global player. Thank you.
Mike, do you want to take that on?
Well, Cheng Li talked about it at the end of his presentation. It was essentially the management of pluralism, as the way I understood the core challenge. And segueing from that observation to your question, I think whatever you want to say about reform of the last 40 years, it has fundamentally changed Chinese society, organization of the economy in many respects, middle class, all of these things. And that the institutions capable of managing this, just take the example of the stock market fiasco where they're trying to pump up the stock market and then deflate the stock market and capital controls and so on. This is not institutional, predictable management of a pluralized economy. And so I think ultimately the question is, an institutional question, is China going to be able to build the institutions that can productively manage pluralism? And I don't think he's gone very far on that core task. And I'm waiting to see. The other thing I think is a fundamental contradiction in their basic economic policy. We've talked about the third plenum. Just the market will be the decisive allocator of resources in the Chinese economy. That was the operational phrase. Well, if you ask yourself what organization, what mechanism has been the decisive allocator of all resources in China up to, let's say, the third plenum, and I would say to today, answer Chinese Communist Party, or let us say a very important allocator, right? So I don't see how you can move to the decisive allocation of resources in China to an impersonal market and maintain the centrality of the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, ultimately, I don't know how that contradiction will express itself in short time periods, but over the long time period, that's a fundamental. So I see the key problem, which is the inhibitor, that is going to, you know, constrain China action in the world is going to be this problem of institutional development and the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party. And everything you see is a reflection of the fear that the party is, you know, not as solidly ingrained in terms of longevity and adaptability. I hear what was said. This has been a pretty adaptable party. I agree. But on the other hand, it's acting like a very insecure regime in many respects. So I think that's going to be the fundamental inhibitor, whether it's in terms of domestic policy and or dealing abroad.
We'll go right here, and then we'll go back there in a second. The mic's coming just over from that side.
Thanks so much, Chris Nelson, Nelson Report. Incredibly important discussion, both Chengli this morning and you guys just now, and enormously sobering. A quick point on the Taiwan One China thing, and then a question. I think we will need to put a lot of hope and focus on the able representation of TECRO here and TPP here to remind the Trump people when they are in place that if you're going to help us, you need to talk to us before you start to help. Mm-hmm. If it's left to Navarro and Bolton, God help us. But let's see how that one plays out. My question is on the North Korea stuff. Mm-hmm. As you know, because most of you get my scribble.
That's not very valuable.
Thank you. The daily screed. if the ICBM really is the strategic threat, and I tend to agree with Bruce Klinger that we've exaggerated that, but having said that, if it is the strategic threat and it does require kinetic American response, given the point that you guys made, that we need to take Trump more literally perhaps than we thought. If he says you're not getting to your islands, maybe he's going to do something about it. If he says you're not going to get your missile, maybe he's going to do something about it. That is, of course, also leverage. And that it's this transactional thing. In your minds, from dealing with China, is the threat of American military action against North Korea a viable leverage approach, or is that a real recipe for disaster? Because I think that one we can see coming, if it comes at all. Thanks.
I would say it's a very complicated question. It's not a simple yes or no answer, because I certainly felt in the early 2000s, when the situation with North Korea was reaching a crisis point, the Bush administration signaled pretty hard to the Chinese that if China wasn't willing to step up on this issue, the United States might have to. And out of that came the six-party talks process, really. And so in the sense that China recognized that America was serious about the need for action on this problem, I think it was helpful. And certainly the Bush group had great credibility in the idea that they might intervene abroad. And so the Chinese had to take it seriously. I think today, I think they've got to take this seriously. I think that whether the threat is as great or not from a nuclear ICBM in North Korea, I think that an American president, I find it very hard to see how an American president can simply say, oh, that's okay. I also think that we're missing another point here, which is as the North adds to its fissile material stockpile, there is a proliferation problem coming for us. Mm-hmm. And we're not, I don't think, paying enough attention to that question and how we're going to deal with that seriously. So I think that, yes, there is some utility in saying we are reaching the end of the line here and we need China to step up and help us ameliorate this situation.
Can I ask a question, follow-up? And so now we've got our two core allies, certainly in Northeast Asia and probably in Asia, Japan and the Republic of Korea. And so where does our relationship with them stand if we go the logic of force? And then what does that do? We've been talking about alliances in other regards. Now we can toss that set of reasons on the pile.
Well, I think, I think that, look, it's sort of like Secretary Franklin this morning. if we get too far into talking about mm-hmm. what does a trade war look like or what does a war with North Korea look like, we're kind of missing the point of the moment, which is we want to avoid that. Because thinking about that, there are so many horrible things that could happen. A North Korean assault on along the border on the South Koreans. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that this could spin out of control. And that's why it has to be in all our interests, and not just China, Russia. The entire region has to take this problem seriously.
Mm-hmm. I think the gentleman there. Yep.
My name is Jim Keith. I'm a retired U.S. diplomat and a current business consultant. Thank you for the opportunity to hear from all of you, and from you too, Zheng Li. Thank you. Mike, I wanted to expand on the point you just made, this what from the American perspective might be the conundrum between authoritarian control of the country and society with market allocation of resources, and ask anyone on the panel to expand on that in this question of China filling the void that Americans are creating. And perhaps one means of getting at that is to expand a little bit more on the Davos speech, which Secretary Franklin mentioned earlier today. I mean, those of us involved in crafting the responsible stakeholder speech might have been delighted to see the Davos speech as a reply in those days, but the context has changed. I would argue that it's slightly less than invigorating to hear some of the elements of the Davos speech given this domestic conundrum. Does that give you enough to respond on what the boundaries might be in terms of the Chinese filling the void left by the Americans? Thank you.
I think in my remarks I mentioned that I think we have to appreciate actually the scope and the vision of what China, we talk about Obor and now the Belt and Road Initiative and all of that. And a lot of these are going to be projects that aren't in any vision. It's just aggressive local officials throwing it under the umbrella to get support for whatever their pet project may be. So I don't want to overstate what this vision is, but I was struck, even in Vietnam, when you talk about this connectivity that China's trying to build, they're trying to figure out how to relate to it and still keep their autonomy. Everybody sees pluses in this, and everybody sees minuses. And China's dumping enormous amounts of money into Malaysia in port development, urban development, airport development, railroads, the whole nine yards. And it is buying, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, it is using its economic power to get compliance, and it's going to have developmental payoffs for China. It's going to be, its exports of high technology. You mentioned technology. It's impressive what China's done in terms of it's the development of the underlying technologies and high-speed railroads from the French and the Germans, and put it together and modified it and now is exporting it and so forth. Has a huge contract in Boston. So I guess what bothers me is the conjunction of us sort of bailing out on, we haven't been for quite a long time all that enamored of infrastructure abroad in our foreign aid and so forth. I think in the one area where I would see a possibility for this administration seems very sold on the idea of infrastructure, domestically for sure. But I think if we can find a way to relate positively to the development thrust that China is putting out there, somebody asked earlier, where is a conjunction point in terms of interests? And I think building in this really dynamic area and cooperating with China, and all of those countries where I'm interviewing, they all want to see U.S. companies there, which they generally don't, or not nearly to this extent. So at the same time, we have all these strategic and reciprocity issues and so forth. I think there is an area where we can cooperate on development in the most fundamental sense in Asia. I mean, what China's proposing to do now is build more than three transcontinental railroads out of Kunming. I mean, it's just unimaginably huge.
Evan?
Yeah, please, Richard.
I'm going to say you can look a number of ways at the Davos speech. Given the state of the world today, to be making a pitch for hearts and minds at Davos would, be totally politically tone deaf. other than for the people of Davos itself. So the, but also, of course, you know, I think the message is Chinese leadership. It's not really Chinese leadership. You know, I think Xi Jinping was defending the global trading, liberal trading order, not the global liberal order. It was like, you can have the global trading order, we'll just throw the liberal bit out. And, you know, so in that respect, it's tactically astute, but I think pretty transparent.
Do you think, just to round out the, this point, I think is interesting, do you think that when China envisions itself as a, let's call it a kind of, perhaps a form of responsible stakeholder now, or filling in this role of leadership, does that extend to things like humanitarian intervention? Do you think we will begin to see China taking the lead on the next Ebola crisis, the next Zika crisis, the next, you know, when it's time to form some sort of major response? Do you get the sense that China is prepared to do that? Because it has so far hung back, even though it has expanded its commitment, for instance, to UN peacekeeping operations. You get the sense that they don't want to be in the lead position on this.
I think they're still very reluctant. Mm-hmm. You look at the situation in Syria. China hasn't offered to take any of the refugees that I know of. And you mentioned Ebola, very small commitment, at least at the beginning, until we sort of pushed on that. I think in peacekeeping operations, China is now the largest contributor to those. So they've moved out in certain areas, but I think they always have to worry that getting too involved in humanitarian things abroad while they still perceive such great poverty in some areas of China is politically a bit difficult, and I don't think they have the, if you will, the habit and that we have of feeling the need to be directly involved.
Rich, you have a quick
I was going to say, you might, on that question, look closer to home and look at, and I hope this doesn't happen, say the next tsunami crisis in Asia. When that happened previously, of course, it was the U.S. military that was able to deliver goods and services, rescue people very, very quickly, and at the time said, oh, my God, you know, China couldn't do that. And you know, the other side of the coin was, well, thank God they couldn't do that. But I think these days they could. And if there is a natural disaster in Asia, and there regularly are, I think, you know, the Chinese would no doubt be thinking about stepping up themselves. Mm. And that's a very good extension of, you know, I don't think China does have much soft power, but I think that would be a very smart thing to do.
We're down to just the last few minutes here. We're going to, I think what we'll try to do is take three questions at once, and then we'll answer all together. So please, in the second, yeah, right there.
Mike Hiltner at George Mason University. My question is there a way to link negotiations concerning Taiwan with the discussions about North Korea? I was particularly addressed this to the gentleman from the Bush administration, because I know that question came up then. Second question is the sectors that are closed to the U.S. economy, the so-called negative list. They're all sectors that have a very high socialist component of employment, and this is why they're not as easily opened up as earlier sectors were. And I just wonder if you have any commentary on that.
All right, we'll take a question here, just right back there.
Thank you, Jean-François Houtin with the Globalist. One quick question about possible areas of leadership for a Chinese leader. What about the climate, where he would be quickly become a star in Europe if he moves into that area?
All right, and we'll just, let's go ahead and take one last question here. We'll answer as best we can in the allotted time. We just have a few minutes left. Yeah, right here in white, please, in the second round.
Hi, Jen Ng with Shenzhen Media Group. So picking up on Jenna's idea of a contact person with China, we can name a few within the Trump administration that are China critics. But who do you see that are more friendly to China and can potentially continue to have cordial conversations with China? Thank you.
And gents, we may need monosyllabic answers for this, given our time constraints. But if there's anyone who wants to jump in on one of these, I would encourage you.
I was going to say on climate, you know, China has intelligently made a virtue out of necessity. They could continue to do that and win brownie points for that.
I would say Dennis had something that resonated with my thinking, and that is the need for a coordinator. The Chinese system with the vice premier has a real a useful level of the system above the department level, natural coordinators, and we don't seem to have in our structure. And I thought elevating Paulson to sort of primus inter pares was one way to deal with that. I guess making Henry Kissinger in charge of everything at one point was a way to deal with that. I'm not recommending that. But any case, I think we need to get somebody that's going to ride herd, because the wiring diagram that's emerging right at the moment's got a lot of contenders for influence over this policy area.
And I'm not sure it has to be somebody who already has a good relationship in Beijing. We now have an ambassador designate to Beijing that has a very good relationship in Beijing. So he can help to build the bridges from his position, and I commend President Trump, actually, for that choice, because I think it gives the entree necessary for whoever he decides to put in as the... But the key is not whether or not they have a good relationship with the Chinese. It's whether or not that individual understands what the president wants and has the entire backing of the system to move forward.
Right.
And that... sometimes, I can tell you from personal experience, doesn't always happen in the U.S. government. Just very quickly, on tying Taiwan to North Korea, I'm very nervous about tying different issues together. I think that, when we've been most successful, it's when we really work an issue solidly with the Chinese in the lanes. But I may be wrong, but I'm not a believer in tying them together.
All right. Well, I think we are out of time. We've covered a tremendous amount of ground. Thank you all for terrific questions. And please join me in thanking our terrific panel.
Yeah.